Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon, and I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
People from across the country are throwing their support behind a new campaign taking aim at racism and sexism. It's called Make It Awkward, or hashtag Make It Awkward, and it urges people to confront offensive remarks or actions when they see them or hear them. And it all got started after this video was captured in downtown Edmonton. It was taken during a production shoot with Jesse Lipscomb, who you can see sort of there, an actor and producer. He's walking down the street when he was targeted by racist slurs from that dude in the car. And rather than walk away, he walked over to the car and he just calmly confronted the men inside. And he posted the video on social media sites and invited a national conversation on how to end racism. Well, Edmonton Mayor Don Iveson has joined this campaign. Where will it go from here, and how is it supposed to empower people to deal with racism? Joining me now from Edmonton, the mayor of Edmonton, Don Iveson. Nice to see you, Mayor.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with that video. You know, when I saw it last week, I was a little surprised at what I saw and the fact that it was from Edmonton. What did you make of the video?
Well, you know, we haven't seen documentation of this kind of awful behavior until more recently. And you know, there's competing theories going around. One certainly is that there are more and more cameras everywhere. Jesse happened to be filming a PSA for the city about the awesome things that are happening with our new arena and a bunch of other revitalization things that are happening, and how much he loves living in the city of Edmonton. So it's a very strange irony that these disappointing individuals drove by in their car and started saying what they said. And other people are equating this a little bit to, you know, the permissibility of saying inappropriate things because of what's happening in the States right now, which I think, you know, as Canadians, we're reviled by that. And so it is distressing to see. But on the flip side, you know, Jesse has shown incredible leadership amplifying this and turning it around into a conversation about the need to call this out for what it is and also address more casual racism and more casual forms of discrimination towards other groups. So, you know, in the end, it's been a positive thing.
Well, we'll talk about the campaign in a minute. But, you know, I remember, I don't know how long ago it was now, when my hometown, Winnipeg, was called racist, right, by Maclean's magazine. And the mayor, Mayor Bowman, had to really talk about it and make it a conversation and sort of went on the offensive to try and get that stigma erased from Winnipeg. Do you think that Edmonton is racist? And is there anything that anything beyond what this campaign is that you can do to combat that?
Well, a city is, it doesn't make much sense to talk about a city as being racist or not, because a city is a collection of people who hopefully stand for certain things. And cities increasingly are the places where diverse populations, especially in Canada, we exemplify this, come together to build something better, you know, as a community. And so certainly I think there are pockets of racism. I think casual racism and inappropriate commentary like that is far more widespread than most people would care to admit. But I tell you, I felt really bad for Mayor Bowman when that happened, because I thought, you know what, this is not fair to single out a single Canadian city. This problem exists in every single one of our communities, large and small. And I think that's why we need to address this at the local level, but also as a national issue, because it's not the Canada we think we are. And we need to confront that.
So I know you've had some support both from the Premier. I saw the Prime Minister tweeting about the campaign. Tell us about what appealed to you about it. And was it Jesse Lipscomb that came to you and said, what do you think of this? How did that work?
Well, I happen to know Jesse a little bit because he's a fantastic community leader and a brilliant entrepreneur and an actor and a creator and a filmmaker. And so I phoned him, actually, shortly after I saw the video, just to see how he was doing. And we agreed that we'd get together and see if we could turn this into a more positive conversation about the need to call it what it is, racism and bigotry, and challenge it, even if it's casual, even if it's just an offhand remark around the locker room or the water cooler, wherever it happens, that we need to challenge that. We need to call it for what it is and have a value shift. And this is a hearts and minds thing. So it's easy to do. And we wanted to engage young people who have real moral clarity on these questions, because racism and other forms of discrimination are learned behaviors. I don't at all for a minute think people are born this way. And Jesse and I sort of were finishing each other's sentences and thinking about how we're going to respond to this. But it was actually Jesse's partner, Julia, who came up with the hashtag Make It Awkward based on some social media interaction she was having with people who were supporting her and her partner as they were going through this. And so the three of us met the next day and wrote it down, and it went from there. And the response from across the country, from Indigenous community leaders, disability advocates, LGBT community leaders, it's just gone so far and wide. It's been really great, gratifying to see.
So what are you hoping people do with this, though? I mean, do you want people to confront people who are being racist to your face? And you know, that could lead to all sorts of problems. Do you want them to call it out on social media? How do you see this actually working?
Well, there's a fine line here, and it's a very Canadian line, too. You know, and I think about the spirit of peacekeeping is in a peaceable way and in a non-confrontational way, but in a constructive way, we need to challenge these things. So if there's someone in the workplace who is getting away with saying inappropriate things, posting inappropriate content, whatever, then that needs to be challenged somehow. And if people feel safe to do so and have support around them to do so, start the conversation. It may be an awkward conversation, but, you know, so many people have reported to me times when they've done that. Well, you know, when they just say, you know, there's a racist comment in the workplace and someone says, explain that to me. What do you mean by that? Mm. What are you basing that on? And that, you know, people just realize immediately how inappropriate it was, that they've repeated something that they heard that they thought was funny because they didn't think about it very hard. And as soon as you're challenged with a bit of awkwardness to think about it, then there's an opportunity to change the conversation. And that's really the social change that needs to happen here over time, is to call this behavior out, whether it's overt and ugly like what we saw in the video, or whether it's casual and everyday, or systemic, frankly, if there are other barriers that people are facing that limit their full participation in community life. We have to have some awkward conversations about that. That's a good thing.
Have you ever done that? I mean, you know, you're in a leadership position. You're also white, though, so you're not encountering these instances that often. Have you ever been at a table with a bunch of people and said, "Yo, I don't like what you guys are saying here. What is this about?"
I have, it's hard to do. But if you're in a room with people who are otherwise, you know, thoughtful and respectable individuals who are just don't realize that this is not acceptable and need to be challenged, then, you know, it can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I certainly come from a position of privilege in our community as a male of European descent, and I've come to recognize that more and more with the work that I do with vulnerable communities here in Edmonton. But Jesse and I both are fathers of mixed families, mm-hmm. and so both of us are thinking about the experiences our kids will have who are sort of, you know, racially, and that word's outmoded, but sort of in terms of their appearance, mm-hmm. it's sort of hard to pin down what they are.
Yeah.
And so certainly we don't want any of our kids or anyone else's kids, regardless of what they look like, regardless of their ability, regardless of their gender expression or sexual identity, to have to experience this kind of nonsense, not in this day and age. So, but clearly we still have work to do.
Yeah, and you're starting a conversation, which is sometimes how these things get going. So the hashtag is Make It Awkward, and we'll check back and see if there's anything concrete that happens from it. Mayor, appreciate your time today.
Well, we're meeting this week to build the campaign from here, and there's allies from across the country, okay. So we'll definitely check back in with
Sounds
you.
Good. Thanks, Don Iveson.
Pleasure.
A group of Black Lives Matter protesters shut down an airport today, not here in the U.S., but in Britain. This morning, several British members of the movement shut down London City Airport after they chained themselves together on a runway. In a statement, they said they wanted to highlight the way climate change has a disproportionate effect on black people globally, and that, quote, black people are the first to die, not the first to fly, in this racist climate crisis, end quote. Joseph Harker is The Guardian's deputy opinion editor and a former editor of the weekly newspaper Black Britain.
I'm not surprised because it's been such a successful movement in the States in terms of building awareness of the sort of levels of police violence against black people. And it's a feeling that a lot of people in Britain, and I'm sure black people around the world, sympathize with. So it's natural that its success has led people over here to want to reproduce that.
And what is different with the movement there, would you say?
I think the biggest difference is that in the US, there are such shocking and appalling instances of police violence against black people that naturally people are very angry about it and they go onto the streets and they protest about it. I think the difficulty in a way over here is that there's not such extreme levels of police violence. Yes, people do get killed by the police. We saw an example of that just in August with someone being killed by a taser. But there's not the same levels of shootings of unarmed people. And so in a way, it's more difficult to get that same level of emotional engagement in Britain.
Now, the heart of Black Lives Matter in the U.S. Is the African-American community, and many people of color have kind of joined on since. How does that change once you get to the U.K.?
The backdrop is very similar. The black population in Britain is traditionally from the Caribbean, which was, again, an enslaved a community that had been enslaved for generations in the Caribbean before they migrated here to Britain. So there's very many similarities in terms of how black people got to the UK compared to how they got to the US.
Now, it's interesting, these Black Lives Matter protests today at London City Airport, they made a connection to climate change that it disproportionately affects people of color across the world. They've also spoken out about the refugee crisis as a Black Lives Matter issue. What do you make of all of this?
I think those issues are true, but I'm not sure how high up climate change is in terms of the black British experience. I think if you asked 100 black people what your top 10 issues are in terms of racism and discrimination you face in Britain, I think environment and climate change would come very low on the list, if at all. I think it is about jobs, it's about criminal justice, it's about education.
Yeah, why do you think they would make this seemingly far reach?
Well, most of the protesters, it turns out, are actually environmental activists, the white environmental activists. And so, in a way, that's caused another issue with whether that means that they really speak for black British people.
So do you think Black Lives Matter in the UK is kind of struggling for relevance?
I think calling yourself Black Lives Matter immediately makes you compare the situation for black people in the UK with black people in the US. It almost downplays the black British experience. But there are lots of issues. There's a new thing which the police are introducing in Britain now, which is called spit hoods, which are these hoods which are put over suspects' heads when they're arrested. And they're reminiscent of Guantanamo hoods. Mm. And they look absolutely shocking. And surprise, surprise, the first person who's been seen to have a spit hood placed on the head is a black person. And we just know that they are going to be used more against black people than against white people. So there are a lot of issues which people can be very angry about in terms of what's happening in Britain. It's just surprising that they've chosen airports and climate change as their arena when there are so many other things happening.
Joseph Harker, the deputy opinion editor for The Guardian newspaper, speaking with me from London. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Damn you, Obama.
President Obama has cancelled a meeting with the Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte. It comes after Mr. Duterte threatened to swear at Mr. Obama if he raised the issue of drugs-related extrajudicial killings in a meeting that was due to take place on the sidelines of a summit of Southeast Asian nations in Laos. The row has overshadowed the first visit by a U.S. sitting president to Laos, David Campanale reports.
This is the first visit of an incumbent American president to communist Laos.
But the actions of his predecessors are not easily forgotten in the region. During the Vietnam War, US bombers pulverised this small Southeast Asian nation in a failed attempt to thwart a communist takeover. They left a legacy of unexploded ordnance that still kills and injures scores of people every year. President Obama is expected to confront this bitter past during his visit. Locals want evidence of American action. In a side meeting, President Obama had intended to raise the thousands of extrajudicial killings of drug users and pushers in the Philippines. But the country's president moved to get in his retaliation first to his American counterpart.
I am a president of a sovereign state, and we have long ceased to be a colony. I do not have any master except the Filipino people. Nobody but nobody. You must be respectful. Do not just throw away questions and statements.
It's unusual for one president to tell another what to say or not say, but much rarer, as the Philippine leader did here, to say to his country's regional ally and the most powerful man in the world that he's the son of a prostitute. President Obama sounded nonplussed by his acid-tongued counterpart.
I have seen some of those colorful statements in the past, and so clearly he's a colorful guy. And what I've instructed my team to do is to talk to their Philippine counterparts to find out, is this in fact a time where we can have some constructive, productive conversations?
The finding out part didn't seem to require much time. The idea of off-agenda talks between the pair are for now ruled off the agenda.
That was David Campanale.
Check it out. Then we quit running around the park till it's after dark. When we get home, hope the dog don't bark. Puff. See, we was getting fucked up. Right around the park till it's after dark. When we get home, hope the dog don't bark.
Five states hold ballot initiatives this November on whether to legalize recreational marijuana. And many voters and policymakers are studying Colorado's experience, where pot has been legal for nearly 3 years. Still, one issue remains hazy there: how to enforce laws on driving while stoned. Ben Marcus from Colorado Public Radio and Stephanie O'Neill of member station KPCC in Los Angeles report.
This story starts with a stay-at-home mom from the Denver suburbs.
Her name is Abby McLean, and she was driving home from a late dinner with a friend 2 years ago when she came upon a DUI roadside checkpoint.
I haven't drank or smoked anything, so I was like, let's go through the checkpoint.
McLean is a regular marijuana user, like 5 times a day, but she insists she never drives while high.
Still, the cop at the checkpoint tells her he smells marijuana, that her eyes are bloodshot. Eventually, he whips out handcuffs, and McLean freaks.
Like, massive panic attack, and oh my God, I have babies at home, I need to get home, I can't go to jail.
A blood test later revealed McLean had 5 times the legal limit of THC. That's the mind-altering compound in marijuana. So an open-and-shut case, right?
Actually, no. McLean's attorney, Nadav Ashner, had a field day in court with Colorado's marijuana intoxication limit.
Even the state's experts will say that number alone is something, but generally not enough, and we really hammered that home.
Ashner got a hung jury, and McLean pleaded to a lesser offense. But hers is just one of a number of Colorado cases where this is now happening.
Turns out measuring a person's THC level is actually a poor indicator of intoxication because, unlike alcohol, THC stores in your fat. Tom Marcotte is co-director of the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research at the University of California, San Diego.
Unlike alcohol, which has a generally linear relationship between the amount of alcohol you consume, your breath alcohol contents, and driving performance, the THC route of metabolism is very different.
And that's why adapting drunk driving laws to marijuana makes for bad policy, says Mark Kleiman. He's a professor of public policy at New York University.
You can be positive for THC a week after the last time you used cannabis. Not subjectively impaired at all, not impaired at all by any objective measure, but still positive.
Still, Colorado and five other states have such laws on the books because pretty much everyone agrees that driving while stoned can be dangerous, especially when combined with alcohol.
What cops really need is a simple roadside sobriety test, and a common iPad may offer that solution.
The scientists at UC San Diego are now working on several iPad apps that could eventually be used to measure how impaired you are behind the wheel. Like one where you have to follow a square moving around a screen with your finger, which measures something called critical tracking. And then there's this other one that measures time distortion because things slow way down when you're high.
But that's all still experimental. In the meantime, some regular marijuana users like Abby McLean are scared to drive for fear of failed blood tests.
I haven't gone out really since then because I'm paranoid to run into the same surprise. Uh-oh, there's a DUI checkpoint.
A checkpoint that for McLean could mean potentially thousands more dollars in attorney's fees to defend herself. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie O'Neill in Los Angeles.
And I'm Ben Marcus in Denver. Yeah.
What's up?
Now for an issue that doesn't get a lot of time on the campaign trail, but will be something the next president has to deal with. What to do about the nation's growing patchwork of marijuana laws? That's our topic on this week's Platform Check, where we examine what the candidates would do if they were president. NPR's justice correspondent Carrie Johnson is in the studio with us. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hey, Audie.
So 9 states will vote on marijuana-related ballot measures this fall. 5 would legalize the drug for recreational use, 4 for medical use. But under federal law right now, it's still illegal to possess or sell marijuana, right?
Absolutely. Marijuana is tightly restricted under the Controlled Substances Act. Authorities believe it has a high potential for abuse, and there's no federal currently accepted medical use. Under the law, it gets the same treatment as heroin and LSD. And just last month, the Drug Enforcement Administration rejected attempts to loosen some of those restrictions on marijuana, what's called rescheduling the drug. Here's what the DEA leader Chuck Rosenberg told me about that.
Well, marijuana is not as dangerous as heroin, for instance. Clearly not as dangerous. But this decision isn't based on danger. This decision is based on whether or not marijuana, as determined by the FDA, is a safe and effective medicine. And it's not.
The DEA did open up a way for more universities and institutions to grow marijuana for federal research purposes. And the Obama administration says it does support a lot more study of whether some component part of marijuana could be useful for medical patients.
All right, so that's where things stand right now at this White House. And we're going to dig into what the presidential candidates have been saying, starting with Hillary Clinton.
Clinton says she wants to reschedule marijuana to loosen some of those restrictions on it. She talked about her thinking on a town hall on ABC this year.
And we need to be doing research on it because I am 100% in favor of medical uses for marijuana, but I want to know what the evidence is. I'm also someone who believes that the states can be those laboratories of democracy. So I'm watching carefully what's happening in the states that have legalized it.
In other words, Hillary Clinton wants more science and to leave things to the states.
Now, what has Donald Trump said about all this?
Audie, it's been a little bit difficult to pin Donald Trump down. The campaign didn't respond to my request for detailed information. 25 years ago, long before Donald Trump became a national political figure, he said he backed legalization of marijuana, at least for adults. But Bill O'Reilly, the Fox News host, asked Trump about his position on this issue back in February.
I would really want to think about that one, Bill, because in some ways I think it's good and in other ways it's bad. I do want to see what the medical effects are.
Audie, Trump went on to say he's 100% in favor of medical marijuana. I talked today with Michael Collins of the Drug Policy Alliance, which supports legalizing the drug. And Collins told me that close aides to Donald Trump, people like New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, have taken a hard line against marijuana legalization.
Now, what about the third-party candidates Jill Stein and Gary Johnson? I know this issue does come up quite a bit for them.
Yeah, Gary Johnson actually worked as CEO of a marijuana business, a job that he left to run as the Libertarian candidate for the White House. He has openly talked about his use of medical marijuana, though he says he stopped doing that when he began the run for the White House. He's endorsed by the Marijuana Policy Project, which has given him an A-plus on the issue. They gave Jill Stein of the Green Party an A-plus as well.
That's NPR's justice correspondent, Carrie Johnson. Carrie, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I'm not sure anymore just how it happened before. The places that I knew were sunny and blue. I can feel it deep inside, this black nigger's pride. I have no fear when I say, and I say it every day, every nigger is a star. Every nigger is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigger is a star?
Tempers flare tonight in Midland City as the city council are still avoiding questions about the interim mayor. Patsy Skipper is accused of posting a racial slur on her Facebook against the mayor-elect. Now, tonight was the first city council meeting since the election. WTVY's Nicholas Phillips was at that meeting. He joins us now. And Nick, I've heard there was quite the crowd.
Well, to say it was a packed house in Midland City is an understatement. As soon as the council got through the regular agenda, questions about their character were immediately brought up.
Just let me say something. Why don't you shut your mouth and let us
say something? All of the hate and discontent that has plagued us.
Emotions were high for both Midland City councilmen and citizens Tuesday, as the issue of race and the mayor's office were still in the air.
As I said earlier, they have no regard for the thoughts and opinions of the people that they actually work for.
Midland City resident Gerald Williams brought forth a petition signed by over 100 people asking interim mayor Patsy Skipper to resign.
We have a lot of people that want her to resign effective immediately.
Williams says they also have over 200 signatures online. The petition was presented after Councilman George Williams brought up the post using the N-word on Skipper's Facebook page. She still insists her page was hacked.
Most of them have no comment, nothing to say. I think that's cowardly.
You have a comment?
No comment.
The comment sparked outrage. The Alabama NAACP called for an investigation. A representative was at the meeting, but wouldn't go into detail about their plan of action.
Sending documents up to the state.
Gerald says council members should be able to answer tough questions and not just respond with no comment.
They work for us. That is how it actually goes. They are supposed to represent us and do what it is as for the will of the people.
Skipper was not at tonight's meeting. Councilman Mal Adams said it was because she's still recovering from surgery. Devin?
Thanks a lot, Nick. And newly elected Mayor Joanne Bennett Grimsley will take office November 7th.
They say they want you successful, but then they make it stressful. You start keeping pace, they start changing up the tempo. Now, who is the cat riding out on the town? State trooper want to stop him in his ride, pat him down.
Mr. Nigga. Nigga, nigga, he got the speakers in the truck with the bass on crumb.
Now, who is the cat with the $100 bill? They got the Senate in the tab to make sure the shit is real.
Mr. Nigga. Nigga,
nigga, nigga, nigga, nigga, nigga, nigga.
Well, it makes me upset, and then it makes me feel really sad.
Emotional reaction to the arrest of a Scott County man accused in a racially charged attack on a local firefighter. And good evening. When Charleston firefighters responded to a house fire in Dielstadt last Friday, they couldn't have predicted what would happen to one of their own.
Authorities say the homeowner, 60-year-old Douglas Pullen, allegedly called a black firefighter a racial slur, then struck him with a wooden cane. Pullen faces charges of assault on an emergency worker and armed criminal action. Hank Cavanero joins us now live in the studio with reaction to the alleged assault and on the growing effort to better protect first responders.
Jeff and Kathy, law enforcement and community leaders alike are both shocked by not just the alleged physical violence, a physical attack rather, on a Charleston firefighter, but the hateful words police say Douglas Pullen used on that firefighter trying to save his home.
You would think in 2016 that we would be way past that.
Calvin Byrd is a pastor at the New Covenant Ministries in Sykeston. He says the use of racial slurs like the one police describe Douglas Pullen using against a black firefighter doesn't surprise him.
If I'm trying to help you stay out of a dangerous situation, and then the only thing that you can think about is calling me something that will degrade me, then that's just really sad.
He just was trying to help this person out.
One of Sheriff Rick Walter's deputies arrested Pullen the night of the fire. He supports the effort to strengthen the punishment when officers and firefighters come under attack.
My opinion, I think this needs to be in place to help protect the first responders.
You know, we're out here doing a job each and every day, and sometimes it's a thankless job. And any type of protection that we can get for our people, I'm certainly in favor of.
Many states are considering making assaults on all first responders a hate crime.
You know, we're all out here doing the same job. It's all a team effort. Whether you're an EMS provider, whether you're a firefighter.
Again, these guys are responding as first responders for medical or fire or rescue. You know, they're there to help somebody.
Which members of the community, like Pastor Byrd, notice.
But the fact of the matter, these guys put their life on the line. I wouldn't do it.
Pullen will face his two felony charges sometime next week. Kathy?
Hank, thank you. There is movement in all four of our heartland states to make assaulting a police officer, firefighter, or first responder a hate crime. In Missouri, State Senator Mike Parson says he wants to make targeting police officers a hate crime. In Kentucky, the effort's already underway to amend the state's hate crime law to include offenses committed against police, firefighters, and first responders. Tennessee is taking similar steps to cover those public safety employees. And in Illinois, Chicago aldermen are urging state lawmakers to do the same. Right now, Louisiana is the only state to enact a law making it a hate crime to assault police, firefighters, or emergency service workers. California
is on for the person behind a racist hate crime in the East Bay. Someone spray painted a swastika and racial slur on the side of this house before setting it on fire. It happened early this morning along McCormick Court in Antioch. As KPIX5's Jessica Flores explains, the family was lucky to make it out alive.
The suspect used blue spray paint to write a racial slur and draw a Nazi swastika across the front of the Antioch home. And police say before he left, he threw several Molotov cocktails at the home, blocking the front exits.
My 28-year-old daughter woke me up and said, "Mom, the house is on fire."
Three adults and four young children escaped unharmed through a back door. The family used a fire extinguisher to put out some of the flames before the fire department arrived to the home on McCormick Court.
The potential in the way these fires were set for there to be a deadly outcome was very high.
Rashawn Williams says her security cameras show who's behind the racist vandalism, but she says she doesn't recognize the person.
Someone of Caucasian descent, and he looked like he was on videotape, and someone who's, I would say, prejudiced.
She reviewed the video with police.
Saw him light three bottles right there on the sidewalk and then proceed to throw them at the house.
The community today is shocked to see a hate crime in their diverse neighborhood.
It's very sad that we live amongst cruelty and evilness like this.
We're disgusted and appalled that somebody would do this to a family in our community, and we are going to do our best to bring them to justice.
And justice is what the family wants.
But I need to make sure I do whatever I can to protect my family, so no one better not cross my path.
Antioch police say they are looking for at least one suspect. Investigators haven't released a description, and they haven't said if the suspect acted alone. In Antioch, Jessica Flores, KPIX 5.
Cal State Los Angeles students are back on campus now, and one dorm is making a lot of news. The school's Black Student Union asked for a new housing option last year, so the university rolled out the Halsey Scholars Black Living Learning Community. It's a dorm for students who are interested in the black community or who are black. Critics are calling it segregated housing, but Cal State LA student Jonathan Thomas supports the dorm.
it says black housing, they automatically equate it with black only. And it's just people who identify as black. So it can be for anybody.
That sound courtesy of our media partner, NBC4. To give us some perspective on this, we're joined now by Sarah Brown, a reporter with the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she's been covering safe spaces on campus. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Sarah, this dorm may be a new thing at Cal State LA, but themed housing isn't new on college campuses. How common is it?
So it's pretty common. In the reporting that I've done on, you know, living, learning communities, themed housing, you see quite a number of residential areas basically structured around a cultural theme. So it might be African-American culture, it might be Latino culture, it might be Native American culture. So there are dozens and dozens of examples of housing structured around these themes. Just as Cal State LA's new housing opportunity is, where there's been some controversy at places like the University of Connecticut, as well as the University of Iowa, they involve living, learning communities that really are targeted toward black students, very specifically. But at Cal State LA, what officials there have said is that that's not the case at all. This is open to all students who are interested in African-American culture.
And I want to get into some of the criticism that Cal State LA has been receiving, but just lay out for us, how many dorm rooms are there, and is it full? Who's applied? Who lives there?
Are you talking about at Cal State LA?
At Cal State LA, yeah.
So I can't speak specifically to how exactly many. I believe it's a couple of dozen. Officials there have also said that there is a wait list, so obviously it's been very popular. That has also been the case with reporting that I've done at the University of Connecticut and at Iowa. There has also been a lot of interest in these housing communities. And there's a wait list at the University of Connecticut. Typically, these themed houses involve maybe two dozen students at UConn. It's about 50, all living in the same residential area.
And tell us about some of the criticism at UConn and the University of Iowa and how that's played out.
Right. So, as you know, the word segregation has been thrown around a lot by critics. So in the case of Cal State LA, as well as at Iowa and UConn, you've seen headlines like black-only housing and segregated housing for blacks. So a lot of critics are saying, you know, why are campuses segregating black students away from the rest of the population? You know, isn't that problematic in and of itself? And doesn't it miss one of the main reasons students go to college, which is to interact and learn among a diverse student population? And campus officials I talk to will often counter and say, first of all, these housing communities are nothing like segregation because it's voluntary. And they'll add that just because students live in the same residential area doesn't mean that they're cut off from other students on campus. You know, they spend most of their day in classes, in the library, doing extracurriculars with other students on campus. So that's not, you know, the way that the critics portray these communities at all.
And the calling it a safe space on campus, I think, elicits the question, you know, what are students experiencing and, you know, maybe even focusing on Cal State LA that they feel like they need this space?
Right. So particularly on predominantly white campuses, well, you know, one thing you'll often hear from students is that, you know, they are surrounded throughout the day by students, faculty, staff who don't look like them, and that these living and learning communities, these themed houses, allow students to find, you know, community support among peers who understand the unique challenges and difficulties that minority students face on campuses. And, you know, most of these themed houses also involve students taking a course or two together, you know, participating in programming like leadership development training, team building opportunities, that sort of thing. So that's another way that, you know, black students say that, you know, these communities allow them to succeed more, you know, both academically and socially, that sort of thing. I would say that, you know, the way it's interesting because at the University of Chicago, there's been a lot of controversy over a letter that was sent to new students that, you know, basically said, we do not endorse safe spaces. And, you know, but there hasn't been as much conversation about how safe spaces sort of crop up in campus dorms. And these living learning communities is what minority students say, no, this is a safe space for me.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder if some houses are more controversial than others, because, you know, I think we have women's dorms. You can think of LGBT safe spaces, Chicano or Latino safe spaces. I mean, are they all kind of equally controversial?
I wouldn't say so. So I think you've seen a lot more controversy among housing centered around Black culture. There hasn't been as much around, you know, Latino culture or, you know, housing geared toward women, housing geared toward the LGBT community. And I think what, you know, campus officials would say is that, you know, a lot of the ones I've talked to, you know, this controversy is, it mostly seems to be the result of right-leaning or conservative-leaning media outlets drumming up a controversy where there isn't much of one at all.
I wonder, too, because Cal State LA reports about its student body demographics, 50% Latino, 20% Asian American, 15% white, and 10% African American. What does the composition of the student body on a college campus have to do with this conversation?
So I think you'll see that many of these themed houses centered around a particular racial or ethnic culture do crop up on predominantly white campuses. Again, that sort of goes to what I was talking about, you know, where students will, you know, show up on campus and they'll be surrounded by students who do not look like them and who might not understand, you know, their experience growing up, what they went through at home. And they'll go into the classroom and they'll see a professor who doesn't really understand that either. So I think if you look at a number of the campuses where that have these themed houses, most of them tend to be predominantly white. So you'll see, like, UC Berkeley, for example, has an Afro house. Oberlin College in Ohio has an African Heritage house. You know, Wesleyan University in Connecticut has a Malcolm X house. These are all examples of colleges that where white students are the majority, and that's where these themed houses have really taken root.
Sarah Brown is a reporter with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Thanks so much for joining us, Sarah.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me, and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
Tonight, some area residents say they've lost a voice. An activist during the Ferguson unrest, 29-year-old Darren Seals, was murdered before his killer set his car on fire. Good evening. I'm Steve Savard.
And I'm Claire Kellett. His killer is still out there. Fellow activists and friends are speaking to News 4's Justin Andrews about Seals' active stance in demanding change. The story is all new tonight at 6.
Courageous.
Activist Amir Brandy stood on the front lines with Darren Seals.
He had a voice and he didn't bite his tongue.
Following Ferguson, the plain-spoken and courageous young man surged as an advocate who would not back down until he saw change.
Someone is this accepted or this loved, this much supported, and then he gets killed in that way.
Chris Mosley went to high school with the 29-year-old prominent protester. He says Seals was a revolutionary. Mosley says Seals had life struggles, but transformed them into steps of success.
He's the epitome of, I can be one way and I can turn my life around. And not only that, but help others too.
Tuesday morning, police say Seals was found shot to death in a burning car. News 4 has been tracking the search for the suspect. Right now, police don't have any new leads. But they tell us they cannot solve this by themselves. They need your help.
At this point, we don't have anything. And that's where we're at the brick wall. You know, is we're waiting for evidence. We're waiting for just clues from a phone call.
His death has rocked activists across the country, but it's like salt on an open wound for St. Louis area activist, an innovator and mediator, they say, whose voice is now silent, a voice that once demanded change.
Now, there has been speculation that Seals' murder may be related to a similar case from November of 2014 when 20-year-old DeAndre Joshua was found shot to death inside a car in Ferguson. St. Louis County Police say they are aware of those similarities but do not have any information that would point to them being linked. Live in the newsroom tonight, I'm Alexandra Corey, News Channel 5 on your side.
Attica! Attica!
Attica!
Attica!
Attica!
Attica!
Attica!
Attica!
Well, today, prisoners in at least 24 states are set to participate in a nationally coordinated strike that comes on the 45th anniversary of the prison uprising at Attica. Much like the prisoners who took over New York's infamous correctional facility in 1971, today's prisoners are protesting long-term isolation, inadequate health care, overcrowding, violent attacks, and slave labor. Today's actions follow similar protests earlier this year. In March, thousands in Michigan prisons launched a hunger strike after private vendor Aramac Corporation Correctional Services served them unrefrigerated meat, and then the company called Trinity that was brought in to replace them served small portions of watery food. The same company prompted protests in Georgia when it underfed prisoners to the point that one resorted to eating toothpaste.
In May, men in several Alabama prisons began a 10-day strike on International Workers' Day over unpaid labor and poor conditions. Organizers said guards retaliated by serving meals that are significantly smaller than usual, a practice they call bird feeding, and by putting the facilities on lockdown, partially to allow guards to perform jobs normally carried out by prisoners. During the strike, Democracy Now! Spoke with Kinetic Justice, who joined us by phone from Solitary Confinement and Holman Correctional Facility, co-founder of the Free Alabama Movement, one of the organizers of today's strike as well. He was serving his 28th month in solitary for organizing a similar protest in 2014.
These strikes are our methods for challenging mass incarceration. As we understand that the prison system is a continuation of the slave system, and which in all instances is an economical system. Therefore, for the reform and changes that we've been fighting for in Alabama, we've tried petitioning through the courts. We've tried to get in touch with legislators and so forth, and we haven't had any recourse. Therefore, we understood that our incarceration was pretty much about our labor and the money that was being generated through the prison system. Therefore, we began organizing around our labor and used it as a means and a method in order to bring about reform in the Alabama prison system.
That was Kinetic Justice speaking by phone from Solitary Confinement and Holman Correctional Facility in Alabama in May. Well, prisoners striking today say conditions are not much different from those that prompted the largest prison rebellion, one of the largest prison rebellions, 45 years ago at Attica. It was September 9, 1971, when state police raided the upstate New York prison, ending a protest against racism, officer beatings, rancid food, no rehabilitation programs, and forced labor. For 4 days, the unarmed prisoners held 39 prison guards as hostages. On September 13th, then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller ordered armed state troopers to raid the prison. Troopers then shot indiscriminately more than 2,000 rounds. In the end, 39 men would die, including 29 prisoners and 10 guards.
Before we're joined by two guests, I want to turn to Attica prisoner Frank Big Black Smith. He died in 2004 at the age of 70. Big Black, as he was known, became a chief spokesperson of the prisoners during the uprising. In 2000, he and other prisoners won a $12 million agreement from the state of New York. During the uprising, he was forced to lie on a table while officers beat and burned him. He was also threatened with castration and death. This is an excerpt from the film Ghosts of Attica, a Lumiere production made by Court TV that features Frank Big Black Smith and the late Liz Fink, who served as the lead counsel for the former Attica prisoners. The first voice you hear is Big Black.
People laying all over now, all bleeding and bloody and stuff. You know, so everybody know now that it's real, that this is it. You know, they're here now. They're in the yard now. They got control.
State troopers just took their clubs and beat them down the stairs. Broke people's legs, hit them on the tibia and broke tibias. On their back, on their head, in their genitals, on their front. You know, wherever they could hit them, that's where they beat them.
I'm telling you, my name is being called. Where's Big Black? Where's Big Black? Get up, Black, get up. And he busts me with a nigger stick, pickaxe, and got a 38 in his hand. And I gets up, and he, bam, in my side, in my back, and made me run with my hand on my head over to the side. And before I got over there, two, three more correction officers with him now, and everybody's hitting me.
That was Attica prisoner Frank Big Black Smith. He became a chief spokesperson for the prisoners during the uprising. For more on Attica and its legacy, we're joined by two guests. David Rothenberg is with us, member of the Attica Observers Committee, one of the 35 people who was brought into Attica to negotiate on behalf of the prisoners. He went on to found the Fortune Society. And Heather Ann Thompson joins us, an American historian, author, activist, who's written an explosive new book. It's called Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its legacy. She's professor of history at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Her book opens with an epigraph from Attica Correction Officer Edward Cunningham. He says, quote, "You have read in the paper all these years of the My Lai massacre. That was only 170 odd men. We are going to end up with 1,500 men here if things don't go right. At least 1,500. Heather Ann Thompson, explain why you begin with that.
Well, it's really important for folks to realize that this rebellion of nearly 1,300 men for basic human rights ends brutally when the state of New York retakes the prison. And even the hostages were at the end of this rebellion begging the governor not to come in with force and to do the right thing, improve conditions in the prison. And that quote and several others in the very beginning of the book really reflect the desire of all participants to come to a peaceful resolution and finally do something about the terrible conditions in Attica.
For so many years, that 39 number, 39 men dead, the state authorities said that the prisoners slit the throats of their hostages. That turned out not to be true in even one case. Were they all killed by the state troopers?
Yes. On the day of the retaking, every death was at the hands of trooper or correction officer bullets. And the state stood out and told the entire world that the prisoners had, in fact, killed the hostages. And that story had a devastating effect on the long-term, on the future of criminal justice policy in this country. It really fuels the engine of punitive policy. And to this day, citizens will tell you that the prisoners killed the hostages at Attica.
Well, one of the interesting things, this was at a period in American history when racial conflict was perhaps at its strongest, but yet Attica represented an interracial rebellion. There were white inmates and Latino inmates and African-American inmates who banded together. You tell the story of Sam Melville, the Weather Underground member who was in Attica at the time and participated in the rebellion. There were many Latinos. And in fact, when we were in the Young Lords, we actually had a Young Lords group in Attica prison.
Right.
And we had two of our members, Jose Fee Ortiz, who's a leader of the Young Lords, and then Jose Parrish, G.I., who had come out of Attica, who went up there as part of the negotiating committee. So this was really an example of a racial solidarity among an oppressed
group. Indeed. And that's why it was so threatening to the state. Somehow, you have 1,300 men who are otherwise divided by language or political persuasion or ethnicity or race, and they come together over the basic fundamental desire to be treated as human.
David Rothenberg, you were called in by the prisoners, one of 35 people, along with William Kunstler and others, the late, great lawyer. Talk about what your involvement was, why the prisoners you wanted you there, and what you found there.
Well, I had been—Fortune Society had just started, and we were a volunteer organization at the time, but we were in—I was in correspondence with Roger Champin and Herbert Blyden, two of the men who emerged as leaders, and we had a little simple newsletter, which was banned. And we went to court and won. The federal courts ruled, Fortune versus McGinnis, who was the commissioner, that they had no right to censor the inmate reading material. So I think they thought that we were this powerful organization that could make changes. And when they took over and they asked—they didn't trust the state in the negotiation and the demands, they asked for a list of people to come in and act as observers, and my name was on the list. So I got a call from Arthur Reeve, who was an assemblyman from Buffalo, saying, will you come up to Attica? And I said, not alone. And two of the guys from Fortune, Kenny Jackson and Mel Rivers, we flew up into the yard.
And David, the importance of having that group there, because in most prison uprisings, there are no outside witnesses. But here you had this group of people, and not just a counselor and you, but there were elected officials, Tom Wicker of the New York Times. There was a large group of people that went up there and actually then had a different version of events than the official version.
This was a politically sophisticated group of inmates, which is why the state thought that outside revolutionaries were igniting the trouble. What in fact caused the trouble is you can't put 2,000 people in cages, treat them brutally, and not think there's going to be repercussions. That's what happened at Attica.
Can you describe some of these pictures you brought in, and especially, as you know, because you're on WBAI in New York, speak for a radio audience. Describe in detail.
This is the—that's Commissioner Russell Oswald meeting with some of the leaders. I recognize L.D. Barkley and Roger Champ and Herbert Blyden. That's people that I know. I think that's Flip Crowley there.
Another picture is prisoners naked in the yard.
This was horrible. They stripped everybody, and then they put when they brought them inside, they smacked them in their ankles and their knees and their testicles, so that it was brutal. It was, you know, they could have taken over the institution by gassing it, which they did. They didn't have to fire a bullet.
Frank Big Blacksmith, when he was laid out, described, they made him hold a football with his chin, laid out naked on a table as they beat him. Why the football?
It was there.
Heather Ann.
Well, it was there, and he was one of the players on a football team, and he had been targeted because the state accused him of having castrated a guard. So they tortured him to say that if he dropped that football, they were going to shoot him. And he had every reason to believe it, since he had just witnessed, over the course of 15 minutes, an utter massacre.
And Heather Ann Thompson, not only was the scandal of the actual massacre that occurred there at the rebellion itself, but then the cover-up afterward. If you would talk about your quest to find out what actually happened.
Well, so for 45 years, the majority of the records for Attica remain sealed by the state attorney general's office, or at least very difficult to get. And the reason is that for all of the death at Attica, no member of law enforcement was ever held responsible. So the book was the journey to figure out who had created so much trauma, what had happened in the governor's office to lead to this retaking, who were the members of law enforcement that not only shot their weapons, but indeed the highest levels of the state police who worked very hard to tamper with evidence, to conceal evidence, and to protect their own. And that was a key journey for finding out that
traced,
information.
The chain all the way up to Washington, D.C. and the White House, right?
Indeed. The story of Attica resonates nationally and internationally, both because it was televised and people cared very much what happened there, but also because at every level for the next 45 years, from the lowest level workman's comp bureaucrat to the presidency of the United States, the Supreme Court, the Justice Department, everyone turned a blind eye to the torture that continued to go on behind the walls of Attica in the wake of the rebellion. And so that story is very important.
There are heroes in our book, and one of them is Malcolm Bell, who
Indeed.
Was a conservative Republican who was hired by the state to be an investigator, and he couldn't remain quiet because he saw the cover-up. And he emerges from your book as a really heroic figure.
Yes.
It changed his life because he discovered the truth.
There are a few heroes, and they really stand out. The coroner, who went public at great expense to himself to tell the world that, no, in fact, the prisoners hadn't killed the hostages, that it was trooper bullets. Malcolm Bell is a hero because he blew the whistle on the inside of the Attica investigation that, in fact, they were not going to go after the police, no matter that all the deaths were at the police hands.
And what about that call you received from a clerk in Buffalo about this trove of documents?
Well, indeed. I'd been looking and looking for Attica documents. Documents combing upstate New York, and happened upon a whole series of documents that happened to just be in a random room in a courthouse. And frankly, I don't think that they knew what was there. It was a wall full of Attica documents, and the most important in those were evidence from the state's own investigation, its own records about who had done what at Attica.
The Muslim prisoners, David.
In your book, you validate what we witnessed. It was the Muslim brothers that protected the guards that were the hostages. They surrounded them. They knew that they had to be protected and saved.
Heather, indeed. The yard was peaceful the yard was organized in no small measure to the Muslim brothers in the yard, the Attica brothers, who were insistent that the hostages were important and that the men sitting there in that circle would have mattresses to sleep on and food to eat. And that was crucial because at the end, that's why the guards are asking Rockefeller to try to help these guys and do the right thing rather than gun them down, which, of course, is what happens.
Yeah, you also write in your book that Minister Farrakhan, who the prisoners had requested to be one of the negotiators, declined to do so because supposedly the leader of the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad, had told him not to.
Well, that was certainly evidence that I found. But it was interesting because a lot of people were asked to come, and for a variety of reasons, they couldn't be there. And yet, there are so many observers, such as David, and those folks played a remarkable role. I mean, they kept insisting again and again that they stick to the negotiations, that the state negotiated in good faith, and indeed, at the very end, were calling Rockefeller, insisting that he at least come to Attica, at least assure these guys that if they surrendered, that they would not be harmed. And he refused to do it. And
why?
Well, for multiple reasons, but not the least of which was his own political ambitions. His party had moved very much rightward. He wanted to impress the Republican Party that he was tough on crime. But also, it was a black rebellion.
Describe what you write in the book about the breakfast. I'm reading the book, and I just threw it down when she was describing the planning strategy.
They were very clearly intent on going in with force from the very beginning. The only reason, incidentally, they didn't go in earlier was because of the observer team there. And when they finally do go in, I discovered that they deliberately don't tell the prisoners that it's going to be a bloodbath if they don't give up. They don't give them an ultimatum. And while it's happening, Rockefeller is eating a scrambled egg breakfast with bacon in his mansion and is being congratulated by Richard Nixon for having handled this so beautifully.
What about Oswald, the warden, his role?
Well, Oswald was a very tragic figure. Yes. He was a liberal prison reformer. It was his insistence that negotiations continued as long as they did with his own people in the Department of Corrections. But at the end of the day, he proves very ineffective in halting what has been decided above his pay grade, which is there's going to be a retaking.
I always said he was a good man who failed history.
Yeah,
I think
that's right.
He didn't rise because he had been paroled. He became Commissioner of Correction because of his progressive position as parole head. And he was considered a leader. And the fact that he went up there was unprecedented. He went—one of the pictures is him sitting with the—he went in the yard. But he was—he didn't understand them.
Exactly.
He was a—I don't know how you describe a progressive— academic. No, I don't want to blame
the
academics.
I want to ask about the negotiating team, you and the negotiating team. If you had stayed in the yard, would the state troopers have opened fire? What word did you get? Were you told to leave?
We were in and out. And eventually it was reduced down to five people, Clarence Jones, Kunstler, John Dunn, Herman Badillo, because we felt we were too cumbersome a group. But there were points in the—we would meet after the takeover for months and months at Kunstler's house, and the feeling was we would have been killed had we stayed there.
One of the most important things in the book that I discovered was there was a myth for years after Attica that the hostages that were killed was a mistake, accidental, shouldn't have happened. And it's very clear that the state knew the hostages were going to die. They discussed it before they went in, and their own state employees were dispensable. I think it's pretty clear that had the observers been in there, there was no controlling this once it was unleashed. These prisoners were at the mercy of people who had been for 4 days passing out weapons indiscriminately. And when they went in, these troopers took off their identifying badges so that they would not be held accountable for what then happened.
They used some of them use their personal guns as
Absolutely.
Well? Absolutely. And you also seem to talk about this question of when some of the prisoners were killed. Was it all in the initial shooting, or were some deliberately killed by the guards afterwards?
Well, I think the evidence is pretty clear that, as David has said elsewhere, law enforcement had control of this prison from the moment they dropped the gas. The gas is a powder. It clung to people's nasal passages, made them sick, incapacitated everyone in the yard. Then the shooting begins. For 15 minutes, it continues. And what is significant is that all of the observers reported later that they could still hear gunfire many hours later that day. And many of the prisoners reported that not only had people been killed after the retaking, but the very specific men had been targeted by law enforcement.
Barclay and Melville, people have told me that they had seen them alive after the takeover. L.D. Barclay, who was so eloquent and whose voice was heard on national television during the protests, was targeted, as was Sam Melville, who was perceived as a traitor to his race because he was white.
The second epigraph in the book is a quote from the National Guardsman James O'Day, who describes an incident at Attica. This is the National Guardsman, quote, "The officer pulled out a Phillips screwdriver and told the naked inmate to get on his feet or he'd stab the screwdriver into his rectum. Then he just started stabbing him."
That's right. In the aftermath is when the real brutality begins. The doctors are trying to help prisoners while guards are dumping them off of stretchers, kicking them, urinating into wounds, making the most horrific scene unfold. And indeed, this National Guardsman, among many, was trying to tell people outside what was happening. This particular man tried to get the Justice Department to look into this. He called the FBI, he called the Justice Department. And again, at every level, people abandon these guys to this fate.
Why the book is so powerful is a lot of these stories I heard over the years, one by one, from individuals as they came out. To see it collected at one time gives you that overwhelming sense of what the state did and didn't have to do.
And you also say that some of the records you found, investigators concluded that the particular guards killed particular prisoners, but never pursued any attempts to charge them with those.
That's right. And, of course, there are many more records we have yet to see, but the records I did see indicated that despite the attempts of the state police to tamper with evidence and conceal evidence, there was evidence, and that evidence not only indicated specific troopers that had killed specific inmates, but also specific troopers who had killed specific hostages. And those people could have been indicted, and instead the state chose to indict 62 prisoners for all that had gone wrong at Attica, again sending the message to the world that Attica was about prisoner barbarism and that those sorts of people don't deserve basic human rights.
And the names you name have never been named publicly before.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And indeed—
What surprised you most? Who did you talk about?
What surprised me most was actually not the lower-level troopers who I name, but actually the highest-level troopers, the head of the New York State Police, people who would literally step in to make a low-level trooper resign rather than face prosecution, top police officers who are tampering with photographs. But again, the responsibility still lies with the state of New York. They're the ones that sent these guys in and then afterwards allowed these guys to investigate the retaking that they had just carried out.
And the settlement?
The settlement against the
with the prisoners?
Well, the settlement was very important. It took 30 years. It took determination on the part of these men, such as Frank Big Black Smith, to stick with it. But I think the nation was also feeling like they finally got justice. No brother feels like they got justice. It was a pittance for some people. It was $6,500 for a death at the end of the day. And the cost was still there because the state still has not admitted responsibility, still denies that anything happened at Attica.
A comment on the prison strike today.
Well, I think we are back here, and we are back here in no small part because the nation failed to learn the lessons of Attica, and we created one of the most brutal prison societies in the world. And as was the case in Attica, when you treat people as animals and they are human beings, they will resist, and we are seeing that across the country again today.
Every time I talk, they say I'm too aggressive. I was out here spazzing, now y'all get the message. On the field, I'm over reckless on my Odell Beckham.
Odell Beckham Jr.
So while all of this Kaepernick stuff is going on, Leah Dunham, is that how you pronounce her name? I've never heard of her before this week. I guess she does a show on HBO, Girls or something. Never heard of her. Didn't know who she was, didn't know what she looked like, know absolutely nothing about her. All I saw was that she was talking to Amy Schumer. She said some weird stuff about Odell Beckham, and it blew up. And at first, I read it, but I was so caught up in the stuff I was doing with Kaepernick, I didn't actually think about it. You ever did that before? You read something, you're like, that's kind of strange, and you just kind of move on to something else, and then you come back to it and be like, hold up, what? And that's what happened with this situation, with this Lea Dunham person. Apparently, she was at the Met Gala. You know, the Met Gala, big thing with a lot of celebrities, a lot of pretty people, whatever. And I guess she was sitting or around Odell Beckham. And OBJ was just doing whatever famous people do in these type of things. He was fiddling around with his phone. He was looking around at people. And he wasn't paying any attention to her because he doesn't know her. And she writes or says this what she believes he was thinking in his head about, you know, not having, you know, sex with her, and that she looks weird and all of this, you know, stuff that, you know, is he's looking at her like she's not his body type that he wants. It was some weird stuff, man. It was essentially putting thoughts into Odell's mind about him, you know, sexualizing other people in the room, but not sexualizing her, and she was offended, you know, by that. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. Women, not all, some, get upset a lot of times, and sometimes rightfully so, because men objectify them, and maybe not in the politest ways. Like, I'm not so far to say, like, you know, you should be able to say somebody's pretty or beautiful or even sexy. You can say it in a polite way, but sometimes it's not polite. So they get upset about that. But then on the flip side, you pay them no mind and they're upset about that too. So, you know, which one is it? Is it, you know, is it Uchi Wally Wally or a black girl's lost? So, at first, like I said, just weird, right? Just strange. And then I woke up today and really had time to look at it and read what she wrote and her apology and all of the tweets and weird stuff that she was doing. And I started thinking about it, man. Do you know, and you should know, obviously, that, you know, there were times in our country where even looking at a white woman the wrong way to somebody else, you might not have been looking at all, could get you strung up on a tree. Do anybody feel bad for Bill Cosby? Hung. Your life killed. And no one taking the trial for it. No one. Just looking at a white woman. Glancing. Someone thinks that you're glancing at them. Even today, 2016, we've made progress. I will give you that. But even now, 2016, if you're walking around with a white girl, there's still some lingering eyes on you. That's just the way it is. So you have to understand that when you get involved if you're a black guy, you get involved with a white girl. Even today, 2016, white girl can come to your house uninvited, thinking about stealing your jewelry, get kicked out of your house, and the LAPD will send SWAT and arrest you, the black guy. Now, granted, we all don't have, you know, reps like Chris Brown, but still, you can't tell me that there's not stereotypes that still exist between black men and white women. Black men are seen as aggressive, overly sexual, Mandingo warriors. White women are seen as soft, lily white. So accusations come up, and if there are accusations of a white woman against a black man, your guilt is going to be seen a little bit harsher. It's not going to be quite innocent until proven guilty. And the crazy thing about that is, even as a black woman, if a black woman and a white woman accuse a black man of something, and let's say justifiably so, let's say it was for real, let's say it's not something made up or anything, equally, the white woman's story is always going to be taken a little bit more seriously than the black woman. That's messed up. So you can't be putting stuff in black guys' head. We already got enough to deal with. If a white girl walked, if a white girl was, you know, came home with Odell Beckham and he did nothing to her, and she went to the police and was upset about whatever, SWAT would be at Odell Beckham's condo or house or whatever. So this is dangerous. It's dangerous. You can't be putting thoughts into somebody's head that you don't know what they're thinking about. This man doesn't even know you. Never met you. Wasn't rude to you. Wasn't paying you no mind. And you gonna go on and make a statement like that? That he's looking around the room thinking about who he wants to have sex with, and he's objectifying everybody? Are you crazy? Are you literally crazy? But she gets away with it. In some cases, some media people jumped on the story. It was like, yeah, he probably was. White woman privilege. Don't do that. As a black man, we have enough to worry about. Okay? We walk outside. People think we're predators. Super predators. We got the cops. You know, it's hard. You know, other guys. You know, we got a lot of issues that we got to deal with. The last thing we need is somebody putting other thoughts in our heads. We already have stereotypes. Well, he's a predator. Well, now we, even if we're not doing anything, he's a predator in his mind. He's thinking about being a predator. Come on, man.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 10th, 2016. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Looking forward to hearing listeners, non-white listeners, views, thoughts, observations from things that took place over the last week. Definitely chime in if you have commentary. The number to dial, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you could watch the background noise, that would be super appreciated. If you know you're in a noisy environment with a lot of other folks talking, being loud in the background, if you could use your mute button, that would be extra appreciated. Thank you kindly, just to help us preserve the audio quality of the broadcast. Once again, we are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. As I said, listener-supported, counter-racist radio. The PayPal button is in the top right corner on the blog. If you're not in the PayPal, feel free, drop us an email, and we will get you a physical mailing address. Thanks again to all of the folks who have invested, supported, closing in on 8 years broadcasting. Hopefully we have provided some constructive info to help people get a better understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, and how it works. Thanks again. I think I said something about this earlier in the week, but thanks again to all the folks who wrote and helped the folks at TuneIn get on their job and update our feed. It is working. It's been restored for a few days now. I think all of the programs that we've done this week, you could have caught them on TuneIn. Checked it today. It's working fine. So if that's your preferred method for checking out the cows, it should be restored. The address is posted on our Facebook page. I've shared it numerous times, tweeted it out as well. So if you need assistance, help finding it, let me know. You can even just go to just go to the TuneIn page and do a search for racism or white supremacy or even the cows, and it should pop up. You'll see our logo, and you can check it out there. Anywho, quick things that I will share before we get to folks who dialed in. Number one, I did not play an audio clip dealing with this, but I did post it on my Facebook page. I think I tweeted it as well. Surprisingly, I think in the weeks that the whole Colin Kaepernick thing has been going on, I don't think we've played one sound clip related to all of that, and that has not been accidental or happenstance. At any rate, amidst all of this, other athletes have been joining in and taking a knee or sitting during the national anthem, during various sporting contests, other NFL players, and it's even spread out beyond the NFL. This week, there was a report. Megan Rapinoe, this is a gay white woman. She is a member of the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, and she took a knee during the national anthem this past Sunday, and she gave a statement as to why she was doing this, and she said, being a gay, it should have been a gay white woman, but she said being a gay American, but being a gay white woman, I know what it means to look at the flag and not have it protect all of your liberties. It was something small that I could do and something that I plan to keep doing in the future and hopefully spark some meaningful conversation around it. It's important to have white people stand in support of people of color on this. She had a longer statement where she had more to share. In my view, this is a pretty significant act of racism, white supremacy. I said this on my Facebook page, and I want to be very clear. This is not saying go out and mistreat or quote-unquote disrespect anybody who identifies as gay, lesbian, LGBT, anything else, but I am being very queer, unequivocal. The practice, the system of white supremacy, racism, terrorism against black people is in no way comparable to what anybody faces on the basis of being gay. That is not my view. That is based on evidence. If you look at the evidence worldwide, it is simply inaccurate. It is dishonest to try to say that the system of white supremacy, as it is practiced, maintained worldwide by the global white minority, is comparable to how quote-unquote gay people are treated. That is nonsense, and in my view, it is extremely dangerous. I think whites do this sort of thing all the time to spread confusion, to make it seem like racism is equivalent to all these other forms of mistreatment that may happen. I do understand that you do have individuals who are classified as gay who are mistreated. You have incidents and that sort of thing. Yes, that does happen, but that is not a worldwide enterprise to make sure that these people are permanently, eternally abused and terrorized in all areas of people activity. And I guarantee you no one on this planet is going to be able to show you evidence to substantiate such a claim. But I thought this was a significant act of racism. I'm sure there are a good number of victims of racism who might think, well, yes, this white woman, Megan Rapinoe, is the greatest thing ever, and it's so great to see her supporting and all that. I could not disagree more. I would not be surprised if you see more of this as we roll. Moving forward, also thought it was interesting, the Leah Dunham clip. You heard some of that at the end. I saw that earlier in the week. I was a tad confused myself. Leah Dunham, she's the white woman. She, I think, wrote, directed, is most responsible for the HBO show Girls, which I had heard of before. That also got a lot of attention. I think that show is set in New York. I have never seen it. Reading is more important than watching television. But as I understand it, I do remember reading quite a bit about it when it first came out. It's set in New York, and it's focused all on these white women, and there are no black characters in the show, and a lot of people pointed that out and accused her of being racist. That came up again this week when she made her accusations against NFL player Odell Beckham Jr. I was confused because when I first read her article and she was saying all of these odd things, she was at this event at the Met Gala, I guess, that took place this past week or what have you, and he was looking at her odd, or I guess wasn't showing her any attention because of her having on a tuxedo and all of this. He didn't find her attractive, and I mean, it was just so bizarre what she had written. I thought that Odell Beckham Jr. had actually said these things to her, like had verbalized, oh, I don't think you're very attractive and you're shaped like a marshmallow and blah, blah, blah. I thought he had said all of these things, which I wouldn't have had a problem with. I wouldn't have been angry about it. It would have just been, you know, VGQ, he said what he said and moving forward. But then when I continued to look and I got a clearer understanding, and it was like, oh, he did not say any of this. You are just practicing white supremacy and being upset because this black male victim of racism did not show you any attention. Got it. Now I understand. No confusion. This, in my view, would be another illustration of white narcissism. Dr. Welsing talks about this, where I am supposed to, as a white person, white individual, male, female, child, I am supposed to be getting all of the attention. You are supposed to be focused on me, and I can be upset with you if you are showing me attention, and then I can just play it that this savage Negro brute, he was, you know, raping me with his eyeballs, and, you know, I was just so uncomfortable, and I had to scamper away. It just, you know, I was so unnerved. It could have been that way, or she can take it the other route. He didn't show me any attention, and he didn't think I was attractive, and I was, you know, not under his gaze. Just fascinating event. I'm glad some other people talked about it. I know it did get a good bit of attention earlier in the week, the danger of white women all the way around. One of the other things that I thought was important, the whole focus on the 45-year anniversary of the Attica prison revolt. I thought it was very interesting. She, the white woman, and Heather Ann Thompson, who was interviewed on Democracy Now. She did a lot of interviews this week. Her book just came out, Suspected Racist, Heather Ann Thompson. In the other interviews, they did not have the same racial focus. Obviously, white supremacy is a central aspect of the story, but it was emphasized a bit more on Democracy Now. And in particular, one of the things, I would say one of the primary things that leaped out to me, Dr. Frances Kress Welsing, genetic annihilation, keeping your eyes on the balls, the number of times that testicles, genitals came up in that sound clip. And even, I would say, when they shared one of the anecdotes that one of the black inmates, that the white race soldier guard took a screwdriver and threatened to ram it in his rectum. All of that is in the ISIS papers, Dr. Frances Kress Welsing's theory on display. It is incredible. I would encourage folks to go back and reread her text if you do not pick up that sort of thing, or if you do not understand the connection. Even them making one of the black inmates hold a football under his chin while he is nude and being pummeled and threatened with castration, that is, it does not get any clearer in terms of representing what the legend, counter-racist scientist Dr. Frances Kress Welsing talked about, wrote about on this program 31 times. Amazing bit of information. I would certainly encourage folks to do research to get a better grasp of what took place 45 years ago at Attica Prison, upstate New York, and even connecting it with what is happening now. And again, with anniversaries, it seemed like a lot of things converged this weekend, the 45-year anniversary of what happened at the Attica Prison Revolt. This is the 20-year anniversary of the murder of Tupac Shakur, and then the 15-year anniversary of 9/11, amongst other things that have taken place in the early portion early portion of September. Again, as I stated on my Facebook page, the master terrorists are white. Be very clear about that in all the chatter and dialogue that's going to be taking place about terrorism over the next 24, 48 hours. With that, we will get to the phone line. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If we could refrain from using metaphors, that would be appreciated. I don't say that for any other program. I have never said that we should not use metaphors at all. I employ metaphors, analogies, comparisons. I do that myself. I simply state when we discuss racism, white supremacy on the Saturday compensatory call-in, we are supposed to be mindful about how we use words to articulate our views, thoughts, observations on racism, white supremacy. If we could just make an effort to be as simple, explicit, direct in communicating our thoughts. Frequently, a lot of times, metaphors, they are used. They are not accurate. The things that are being compared are not equivalent. I think racists do this frequently on a deliberate basis to spread confusion. I just think a lot of times victims, myself included, think sometimes that in expressing our ideas, sometimes we use metaphors or analogies and what have you, and just not having a total understanding of what racism is, how it works. Sometimes we use metaphors that are not the best and or are simply comparing things that are not equivalent, and that is not helpful. I see that a lot. I think if we could just work to be as unambiguous, direct, and as simple as possible in articulating ourselves, I think that that would be very helpful in solving this problem. That's it. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free, share your thoughts.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Quite briefly, two thoughts come to my mind. In the previous report, I would say when counter-racist logic is razor-sharp codified, it is the goal of the racist white supremacists to trivialize thought and action by injecting a story that can be made to believe is similar, but it's not. The white gay female not standing for the pledge. Counter-racist logic makes white people uncomfortable because it indicts all of them, including the likes of Tim Wise, Peggy McIntosh, you know, that version of racist white supremacy, the more refined ones. Number two, the non-white inmates at Attica in the state of New York were, from my understanding, by watching the Eyes on the Prize and the amount of study that I put behind it, were inspired by George Jackson and the Soledad Brothers revolt that took place in San Quentin. And they were aware that he was murdered at San Quentin months before their insurrection that took place at Attica Prison. And that's all I have to say for right now. Thank you.
I just wanted to know, Gus, what's the meaning of BGQ?
BGQ, it's an acronym. It is in Mr. Neely Fuller Jr.'s writings. It is Victims Guaranteed Qualified, or Victims Guaranteed Qualification. It means that any non-white person, victim of white supremacy, that they are qualified to share any views, observations, thoughts that they have about racism, white supremacy, and or counter-racism, even if the view or position that they take is, I don't think there is such a thing as racism, white supremacy, that they are qualified just on the basis of being non-white, being a victim of racism. They are qualified to take any stance that they want, and that that should not be argued. There should not be any sort of argument or conflict against that person by another non-white person, meaning whatever your view is about racism, white supremacy, I, as a non-white person, I should not have a problem with that. I should not have conflict with you on that basis. You are guaranteed, just on the fact that you are being mistreated in a system of racism, white supremacy, you are guaranteed the right to come to whatever conclusion, analysis, thought that you have about the system or what should be done about this. And I think his goal, Mr. Fuller, I think his goal or his reason behind that concept is to keep down confusion so that, or to keep down conflict so that non-white people are not getting into arguments and bickering with one another because we have different views or perspectives on racism, white supremacy, and or counter-racism. But victims guarantee qualification, I think it should be in all of his writings if you want to check it out. And I think he explained it one of his previous visits on the program. He spent some time to share his thoughts on what it is and why he came up with that concept.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, and to the other callers and the listeners. There are a few things I wanted to touch on. The first thing was the Black Lives Matter in Britain. The clip about that and the fact that they were they shut down an airport in regards to their protests. And earlier, I think it was earlier this week, Thomas has sent an email. I don't know if you saw it, but it was discussing Black Lives Matter. And also, I was looking into the origins of Black Lives Matter, and the people behind the organization as it stands in the United States are white people. It just kind of reminds me of the NAACP, which was also started by white people as well. And I was wondering what white people in Britain might be behind their version of Black Lives Matter, because it seems like, just like if you read the Black Lives Matter website, it actually more speaks towards honoring anti-sexual behavior and the rights of LGBT, whatever letter they're going to choose this week, groups. And it seems to be more geared towards that than anything else, at least if you read, take the time to read what information they provide on their website. So I just wonder what white people might be behind that group in Britain, since they're not really taking an approach towards something of substance. More or less, they're shutting down the airport rather than dealing with, let's say, police brutality against black people there, at least based on the clip. The clip about the burning of the home of the black people in on the West Coast, I think it was in Antioch, California. It was interesting. They had the white male that was being interviewed, and he was talking about how sad it was that they have this kind of hate in their community. And I think that he could have been the person who did the act himself. I don't trust white people, rhetorical ethic, and that being a linchpin of the way they function. They, you know, he could stand there on camera and say whatever he wants to say. But, you know, more than likely, or it's possible, he could probably be the person who actually did it himself, or he might know the culprit. So anytime white people get up and speak about anything having to do with counter-racism in a public forum where black people are being mistreated in such a overt and disrespectful way, I don't trust them whatsoever. So that's just my feeling on that situation. I wanted to say RIP to Prince Buster, the ska pioneer and legend. He died as well. I think it was today, if I'm not mistaken, or yesterday. So I wanted to just say rest in peace to him. Also, today is the anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion in South Carolina, so I wanted to kind of acknowledge that. And then also, I saw an article earlier this week where whites have figured out how to use an EEG, which is, I guess, like an electrical brainwave scanner, to ascertain people's deepest secrets. And what they did was they just had groups of people, I think it was like 2,000 people, and they just basically checked the brainwaves of people that had different issues. One of the groups they spoke about were alcoholics, and they found that when they did a test on multiple alcoholics, they got the same brainwave patterns. So just based on that basic demographic, they're able to find out very deep secrets about people just by seemingly innocuous brainwave patterns that are being emitted through the process of people just being alive. So I found that to be very interesting. And then I sent an email regarding Nate Parker and the fact that, I don't know if you saw it, but the fact that they did a screening of his movie and he had gotten a standing ovation at the end of the film. And I thought about it, and I wrote this in the email, that if white people are working so hard to destroy this film before it comes out, I believe that it must have some constructive value, because anything that agitates the ire of white supremacists is something that is constructive, in my opinion. And I thought about it, and now that we're about to read The Spook Who Sat by the Door, there's no way that white people would want ideas like that of the grandsister Nat Turner, who basically thought about white people the same way I would say that wildlife does. When you have two predatory species and they come in contact with each other, one species will try and take out the other just to knock out competition. Whereas with the ancestor Nat Turner, he thought about the fact that even white children, they would grow up to practice racism and potentially harm other black people. So he went out with the idea of taking all of them out, understanding the fact that that would alleviate potential harm to other black people. And I think ideas like that, or ideas like that are conveyed in The Spook Who Sat by the Door, are ideas that white people do not want to get in the minds of black people via film, especially in the context of white supremacy as practiced in slavery. And the last thing I wanted to touch on was there was an article I sent you regarding white drug use and the fact that now these heroin addicts are using public libraries to use their drugs. So they'll find a nice little quiet corner in a public library where any child or any person can come and basically walk up to them shooting up. And I was just thinking about it, and I wrote in the email that white people get to use drugs wherever they want, like public libraries, and they even get needle accommodations at certain store chains. We have talked about that before. While black people were confined to drug dens and crack houses and are demonized as the face of drug use in America. So I just find that to be very interesting, just the difference between how white people are allowed to do drugs and how they're treated and how black people are. Thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
Prompt listeners again about the metaphors, be direct, explicit. We could not do metaphors for this broadcast. Grand, super appreciated.
I apologize.
No apologies needed, sir. None needed. Other folks that we haven't heard from, if y'all had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers, Lars, everyone else on the line, firefighters. I had a few things I wanted to touch on. First, I wanted to say I did get that article from Lars, and they can shoot up in hospitals, libraries now. I wonder what they're going to do with the books. The part about the college campuses. I think that college campuses are social experiments. And I started to think this recently because I have a cousin who's in her senior year in college, and she has these views, and she considers herself to be a feminist, and she also has this view about white privilege. And, I think that their design... to socially engineer young minds to accept the number one problem in the world, which is racism and white supremacy. And they're taught to think that their education will somehow be their acceptance into whiteness. I don't think it serves the purpose of anyone other than the white students and the white supremacists that have an integrated college campus with dorms. Our brightest young scholars can't effectively learn counter-racism logic or come to counter-racist solutions and tactics if they're housed in the Bill Clinton Tillman or the Thomas Jefferson dorms with the white students. You know, I really think that one thing that they should protest is that they do get their own housing accommodations in campuses, so that way maybe they could come up with some solutions without having those white people, those Sioux joining their clubs and knowing all their business. The Ferguson activist, his killing sounds to me like a Klan killing or a cop killing. His logic tells me, you know, this young man had to be under FBI surveillance just from reading the book and looking at some of his moves. I mean, I know they're watching him. It's not a lot of Malcolm X's and things these days. So they have plenty of people to go and watch, you know, whoever's in charge of, you know, his movement or the Black Panthers or whatever, the new Black Panthers, I should say. But, you know, he was shot in the car. You know, he just died in a way that Black people don't kill people. You know, if he was shot in the car and there's a bunch of missed shots, maybe. But this was done in a way to send a message. And when you hear burning, that usually applies to white people. I could be wrong, but they have a history of burning Black people and burning Black people's things, houses, churches, etc. And in fact, they burnt the other guy too there. And I wouldn't be surprised if those two things were related and the burnings were the cover-up. I would like to say that the white girl probably came on to Odell Beckham. She was flirting, probably flashing him, you know, probably told him in his ear exactly what she wanted. And he said no, and she got offended, and probably offended that he was looking at Black women and non-white women as opposed to white women like herself. She just couldn't figure out why this she as a white woman wasn't the object of this Black man's affection. And lastly, I just wanted to, this had nothing to do with the clips. Just wanted to give a little information. I came across some information. I was listening to a brother, his name's Robert X, and he mentioned this lady, and I did some research, and I just feel like this is very important. Her name is Martine Rothblatt, and she made it rich doing the Human Genome Project. Then she started this company, United Therapeutics, which is a biotechnology company that creates pharmaceutical drugs. And she's best known for founder of Sirius Satellite Radio. Well, in 1982, she was a he. And she married a Black woman named Dina Acton. And they had four children together. They adopted another one. In 1994, he decided she wanted to be a female. And this Black woman, she stuck by, you know, the side as he did his transformation. But she recently started a new religion. This is just totally mind-boggling when you look it up. But she started this new religion, and it's based off of the fact that this Black woman who was ill, she made a robot just like this Black woman that you could talk to and interact, and it'll learn from other people. And the point of this whole religion is you could get this robot and live forever. It'll copy you, it'll, you know, pretty much, you talk to it every day, it starts to think like you, and then, your mind is inside of this robotic body. It's called Bina 48, and I just think people should take a look at it, and I'll mute my line. Thank you very much.
Other folks that we have not heard from, other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we have not heard from.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how everybody doing, man? This Key man from Houston. I'd like to reserve my VGQ. And I didn't really want to say, man, you know, it's very depressing, man, you know, and I know we Black people, you know, one thing we can all agree to as fact is that we are the most mistreated of all the peoples on the planet, right? And then, so you look at all the other, you know, species and everybody. It's a food chain. So you got things in the water that eat the smaller animals and fishes, right? But I think it's something bigger, man. I mean, because now, and I ain't gonna say that it's good white people, but you got some people that's consciously aware or feel sorry. And well, I would say this: you got white people that the white people have been born into this something that's been prepared for them. They don't know how to change it. They don't know what to do. Nobody knows what to do. Not even just to help black people, but to fix life for everybody. I mean, when you look at it, we all here, we got a short stay here. This supposed to be an enjoyed experience, you know, and that's what the average person can kind of understand. The whole every day should be enjoyed. It's because everything what we got going on is put on us by somebody else, right? And I think it's something deeper than just white people, because see, we do, when you get to looking at religions and all this stuff, it's like, okay, but people, we don't even know what we are or how we even got here, you know. And so I think it's kind of, but most definitely now, white supremacy is in full effect. They running it. But, you know, we kind of got to, we have to, and I can't even say that. I don't know who's supposed to solve it. Maybe everybody. And it's kind of like Mr. Fuller said, man, it's overwhelming, man. It's kind of overwhelming because you get to reading and you're looking around and observing, and it's like everything is really basic. Life's supposed to be easy. I mean, because we born here, we get here. Nobody has to get here. We here, and it's like, okay. And then we fall into this system. Everything from the day we born is all about being a slave. School and everything is all about going to work for somebody else. You know what I mean? And I think somewhere we still missing it. Including me, I don't know, you know, but I'm just thinking, you know what I mean? Like, because white people ain't that smart, man. They ain't smart at all. You know, they just got the power. They in control of everything. But you can see the ignorance because they don't even know what to do. So, man, I'm up here in North Dakota, man. Now, black people have started migrating up here since this oil thing came up here, right? But they got jails here. They've been locking their own people up, just like the news one. They losing deaths. You know, white people, you always got white people in jail. They hurt their own self. You know, they're very ignorant. You know what I mean? But it's like, it's something somewhere we ain't catching where we can grab a cup, because, you know, I kind of think, okay, and I'm going to say this and then I'm going to cut off, because, see, I know the one thing, like when I see, say, for instance, you know, this or anybody, man, you walk in this Walmart or something, you see a black and a white person together, you don't even really think nothing. You might don't even look at it or even notice it. I mean, you'll notice it, but, I mean, who think anything about it? You know what I'm saying? But white people have a very, you know, they have these thoughts about different things. Everybody kind of different, but it's something there, man, something that we missing that we ain't grabbing, you know what I mean? And I think that white people supposed to be here too, you know, because they here. And I don't think that they, like us, we all different. But everybody here, and we got to fix And all right, man, let me mute my line, man. I'm going to listen out, though.
Thank you.
Thank you, too, Gus. Appreciate that. Too, man.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to again prompt folks about the metaphors. Seems like we're having difficulty with that. We could not use metaphors on the program for the compensatory calling. That would be appreciated. No metaphors. Just be direct about what it is that we're saying. And I also did want to make sure that I got in. Number one, I have not seen any evidence that there are any white people on the planet who are genuinely interested in ending the system of white supremacy. That would be one. Two, I also haven't seen any evidence that white people are ignorant about what to do in terms of stopping the practice of racism. I have seen, and whites have come on this very program and verbalized, if they wanted to, white people could end this problem quickly, like within 24 hours. Even admitted white supremacist Jane Elliott stated that when she came on this program back in 2010. She did two visits, but she stated that unequivocally, and we've had other whites who've called on the program and said the same thing. That is certainly the position that I have taken. If they wanted to, they could solve this problem very quickly. It is not rocket science. Just stop mistreating individuals who are not white. That's all they would have to do. I just haven't seen any evidence that they have an interest and or the will to do so. I could be in error. Other folks that we have not heard from, do you all have commentary you wanted to share?
Hey, God.
Hang on 1 second, because there are other hands up, people that have not shared. I don't know if they're in a noisy environment where they're not able to share. But we should have time, sir, for once everybody who has not spoken, once they've shared whatever thoughts or views that they have, if you want to make an additional comment, we should have time for that, too. Don't know why they're lollygagging for the day. We certainly are not going to do any extra since people are on. I am looking at the switchboard. I do see the hands, and for whatever reason, they're just not commenting. But we are not doing any extra, so we're not doing the slide in at the last minute. And let me get my 2-3 minutes worth of commentary in once we get ready to wrap things up.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hello to you, Gus. The host, and to all the listeners. The reason I'm chuckling, I was just listening to what you were saying, you know, about people. I remember last night I was listening to you. I caught the end, and you were saying about that, and right at the end, somebody called in. So I just kind of chuckled at what you were saying. But this was a good show tonight. Just some comments about things. The Odell Beckham piece, according to what I read, you know, they were sitting at the table. He just wasn't paying any attention to her. And so, you know, and then she's putting words in putting basically words in his mouth, you know. I mean, you know, it just, if you read the article, it's like this entitlement that, you know, I guess that she felt that she had, that, you know, hey, I'm sitting at the table with you, black man, you should be paying attention to me. And, you know, it becomes, like a joke, but it's really not a joke. And like the gentleman said that was doing the piece, that can be very dangerous, you know, that you're putting this force out there. And I think you said when you first read it, you know, you thought he was saying that, and you come to find out this is her imagination running wild. And, you know, it's just so strange. It's up to the point that I would like to believe it gets to the point that when black men, you know, somebody say, hey, we're going to sit you at the table with this white woman, that you just need to say, no, that's all right. You know, I'll go sit over here in the corner, you know. Because, I mean, you, what you have to do to protect yourself. I mean, I was just reading a story on Twitter earlier this evening of a football player at Auburn University in Alabama. This girl sends an email to the coach. The coach saying that this guy abused her. The coach sends the email to the Title IX or Title X personal campus coordinator. And so that person gets in touch with the girl. So the girl tells the person, you see this happened, she tells the coordinator that it didn't happen. She lied. And she was saying that the coordinator basically was still trying to pursue this. And even with the way the story was written, it's just like she was taking it off of herself, the young lady who lied, and kind of like putting it on the coordinator. Well, the coach let the guy go. He dismissed him. Then he tried to come with this story that, well, you know, since the coach was kind of like saying that it had nothing to do with this. There were just other things. And it's just like, come on. So I was reading it, the story, and they were on the site, and they were saying that the site would not, they would not identify who she was. And come to find out, what she was mad about was that I guess she was in his room, and I guess they had a little argument, and he told her to get out. And he escorted her out, so she went and told the story, you know, told this lie. And I saw I saw it on Facebook, because a Facebook friend of mine was like, basically saying she, you know, telling her son, you really have to be careful about these women, because, you know, this is something that's going on. There's another story of a white girl who is some football player, and she was emailing her friend or texting her friends, telling them to say, he dragged me out the car, you know, basically lying on this guy to try to get him in trouble. And I'm just like, wow. So, you know, it's just like, you know, black men, it's just like, you have to be careful. You know, you can't just walk around me, because the Odell Beckham story really speaks volumes. You know, somebody sitting at a table minding his own business, and a white woman who feels she's entitled, and henceforth, you are supposed to pay attention to me, and since you don't pay attention to me, I'm going to put words to your mouth and put this out there, and then when she gets called on it, she deletes it or tries to come up with this lame apology. So I just really thought that was something. The prison story, you know, it just, I think last week, Ron's made the statement about, it was something about a commercial with a mattress and how the you know that sheet, and then the people's like, oh, you know, we haven't been counting you, we just lying. And Roz was saying how they just lied, and the prison thing, when the woman said that the state put out, or the governor's office, or what have you, that the hostages were killed by the prisoners, and the woman said, even to this day, people still say that the hostages killed them. And when it comes to find out that you know, the guards and what have you killed the hostages. And so, you know, and she's saying, you know, even to this day, people still, you know, when it comes to prisons, you know, and there are people who feel that, you know, they need to be treated worse than animals. You need to give them rancid food. You need to give them that they're in prison. So I just, you know, thought that was an interesting story. And then, like somebody says, it's, what, 45 years later, and now you begin to get some of the truth, you know, because, you know, white people will lie, and they will lie and maintain their lies. I mean, we're still being told that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy, you know, and while, you know, we know, I like to say we know that's not true, and there's still things that still need to be told about that story. So, I mean, they will lie. I mean, that's just, that's liars lie, cheaters cheat. That's what they do, you know. And that was something else. And then just to, I can't think about myself, but to piggyback on it, I do agree with you. I don't see nothing. White people do not want this system to change. No one, if a system is wholly in your favor, you are not going to change that system. I don't care what kind of lip service you give to people, which is, in my opinion, not some of our fault that we continue to listen to the lip service. But, you know, white people are not going to change the system. And I do agree, like you said, Jane Elliott said, they can change it if they want to. But no one's going to change the system where everyone is in their favor. And I just think there are things that as black people, I think that's something we have to realize. And we have to stop listening, and we just have to start doing for ourselves. But if we're going to sit around here thinking that these people are going to help change the system, you know, to, you know, a system of justice where everybody is treated just, you know, where everybody is treated just, but that's not going to happen, you know, because I think also, too, we have to realize that there's a great psychological effect in the things that go on in white people's heads. Just like it was your program one time, Mr. Wynn, your program that you talk about, basically how the enjoyment, that's my word, that white people get off looking at continual coverage of, like, the murder of Mike Brown, the murder of Trayvon Martin, you know, to see black people getting killed in the streets and stuff like that, and they can watch that stuff over and over, and media can loop that over and over, and they're getting some kind of, you know, having some kind of homoerotic sensations and things with this. So I think we have to, black people have to, we just have to think. We have to think and stop falling for the okey-doke. And I just want to say this, I think, if Thomas of New York, if he's still listening, could he give that lady's name again? Because I really would like to look that up, what he was talking about. And I'll mute my line with that. Thank you.
I'm sure.
Her name is Martine Rothblatt. Martine, it was Martin, but she changed it to Martine, and her last name is Rothblatt, R-O-T-H-B-L-A-T-T. And you'll find her if you look up Sirius Radio, Wikipedia, it'll come right up.
Okay, thank you.
Grand. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free.
Can I be here?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, Gus, everyone. Greetings. This is Puff. I was listening to the clips there, but something that was not involved in your clips, if this Lena Dunham, she feel like she's projecting her, you know, sexualization onto other black men. Don't nobody want, black or white, don't nobody want that milky, nasty body, I can't even explain it, man, non-shape having, nobody wants that. Anyway, you know, if that incident, you know, speaks, you know, chapters or whatever, that Chris Brown incident that happened last week speaks volumes. This Chris Brown incident that took the cat. I mean, that's a case in point of the power that white women have over black men. Just the accusation. Now, I'm telling you now, a white woman's word can put helicopters in the air, wasting gas. Oh, just a word or something. Now, can you imagine if he didn't even do nothing to her. He put her out of his house. It's his house. He don't even, the whole thing just go to show you that black people don't really have no rights, no matter if they millionaires or if they a level above food stamps. Irregardless, it show you the power of white supremacy. That this man could get arrested and taken out of his home for putting somebody out of his home that he don't want there. And California is, I think, an open carry state. But, you know, he was a fella, so he can't carry a pistol. But even she, in her witness statement, said that he didn't pull a gun on her. He said somebody that was showing some jewelry was doing something. And went off on her, and rightfully so. Yeah, millions of dollars worth of diamonds there. And so the whole thing, man, just is a case in point of, you know, the white people can ruin your life in 5 minutes. It didn't even take 5 minutes. And then they found the text. Then it took later. Now he got to pay Mark Garagos, which I'm sure is right up there neck and neck with Robert Shapiro as far as billing rates. This man don't come cheap. And just like one of the other callers mentioned, not everybody have that kind of money to get that kind of legal representation for that. So it don't even take 5 minutes. In that case, white people can ruin your life in 5 minutes. It didn't even take 5 minutes. The attorney showed that girl had texts. She texted somebody else and said that she was going to set him up. And it's still wasting gas with helicopters and stuff on her. I mean, my life. Go ahead. the next person.
Just wanted to insert really quick, just for accuracy's sake, we did include an audio clip on the incident with Odell Beckham Jr. That was the last audio clip that was played. And the case that was mentioned by our female caller in Ohio, it's Javon Robinson is the black football player who was tossed from Auburn's football team over these allegations. Suspect that it was a white female student who made these allegations that he raped her or did something sexual, and did admitted that this was not the case, that she lied, and they still removed him from the team. I did post one of the reports. It's titled, Female Student Admits to Incredible Lie That Got Auburn Football Player Kicked Off Team. You can check it out at the Facebook page. Other folks that we have not heard from, did you have commentary?
Hello, can I be heard?
Your volume is very low.
Very low? Okay, just a second here.
Is that better?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so basically, to go along with the last caller and kind of what seems to be a theme for tonight, I wanted to start my contribution by mentioning that along with the Lena Dunham incident, the person that was on the interview with her for that, I think it was a broadcast or it was a blog. I think it was called Letters for Lenny. This was an interview with Lena Dunham and Amy Schumer. And Amy Schumer is a comedian who has been noted for stealing jokes and telling just really crude racist jokes. She was noted for making a statement earlier this week that suggested she was a believer in this white supremacist talking point that black people are somehow statistically more likely to engage in sexual harassment. And this is just kind of the latest in a string of very racist actions by Amy Schumer. And I just want to note that if any listener has any doubt that this person, Amy Schumer, is a racist, I think that one thing that I've noted is that there's a number of non-white people out there that have this idea that Amy Schumer is somehow cool or somehow down or whatever. But I just wanted to note that this is a suspected racist that even dates a man that is online in blackface. So, I mean, like, that is how racist this person gets with her functions. All of her jokes seem to revolve around demonizing non-white males for being, in her mind, sexual predators. And this is just goes along with a theme that we've been discussing all night that, hey, white women are instrumental in initiating tremendous incidences of racism, white supremacy. And something else that I would like to note is that along with Amy Schumer telling all of these crime stat allusions, you know, this comes on the heels of everything that we've seen revolving around the terrorism going against non-white people. I think it should be noted that Dylann Roof also made mention of supposedly non-white males raping white females. And then you can go back to, I think, Donald Trump. He's running, he started his campaign with that call of, hey, non-white males are coming here and raping white females. I think the governor of Maine was on the record for making this, I guess, allusion that, hey, non-white males are coming to their state selling drugs and impregnating white females. So this is just a theme that is seems to be constant within the system of white supremacy, and it should be noted. And these people are not down. I don't know what you would make, what would make you think that just off the merits of them being a white woman. I think that's what's going on in a lot of these cases. Also, something that has been alluded to is that a lot of racism is being automated and is being put to robotic applications. Bina 48 is definitely one of the most peculiar creations that I've ever witnessed. It seems that they are trying to replace black people with robots who are black. And the fact that this is a robot that's based on a woman who is a non-white female that is married to a white male or a white female or a, I'm confused on that part, but I think that they are programming these robots to be black people who may have a distaste for other black people, oddly enough. So that might be one of the end goals of that mission. But CNN reported earlier this week that they issued a report that said math is racist. That was the headline. And I think that was a clickbaity a title that could be called clickbait. But it said that math is racist. And it was basically discussing all of the ways that white supremacists have automated white supremacy in the form of algorithms. And they apply these to different applications like personality examinations. And I know about this personally because I was responsible for selling software that was, at the end of the day, engineered to get around OFCCP compliance standards through the usage of these tests. I didn't realize that until later, but still, that's something that is going on. The news is basically, I guess, boasting about this and advertising this now. And that's going on. And then following that, on the heels of that, The Guardian, I believe, published an article about a beauty contest that was judged by AI robots. And the end result was that all of the winners of this beauty contest were all people that could be classified as white, or there was one that was non-white and was perceivably Asian. But the rest were all very white, and all of the standards that were programmed into this machine was basically done by Eastern European scientists, and I suspect they may be white supremacists. And of course, their algorithms have come out to have racist outcomes. So that's something that we should be paying close attention to, is the fact that, hey, they have this down to the math that that they're coming out with. So a lot of new technologies may have racist applications inbuilt into them. And also, I just want to make a note on that note. You know, there's been a number of different examples of facial recognition software not being able to detect faces of people who are classified as black or people who have darker skin tones. So that's something that should be noted as well. And with that said, I guess I'll mute my line. Thank you so much.
For sure. Other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free. Anybody that we missed who had a hand up who has not been able to comment at all? Not sure if that is a response or not. Before I double check, there was a person who wrote in about the pipeline situation going on in North Dakota. I was in the process of listening, getting more information, listening to some of the radio reports about it. And then as I was checking, I saw that President Obama made an order that they were ordering them to stop the drilling process that was happening in North Dakota. If people were paying attention, there were a lot of protests this week. Non-white people were bitten by dogs and arrested. I even saw today that my BFF, Amy Goodman, they have an arrest warrant issued for her in North Dakota. She was there, I think, Wednesday, sometime in the middle of the week, covering everything. Did folks catch what was going down this week with the protests in North Dakota? Have any views on that within the context?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. That was quite amazing. You know, what my views was initially is, you know, look at the fake Indians. look what's going on with them. But I feel bad for them. But from what I understand, that they have the legal right to kick them off because they sold that land or somehow the government confiscated it. However, when I saw them sticking the dogs on them, I mean, that was just like, I brought back Birmingham, you know, type, you know, flashback. Like, wow, I mean, they're going to the same playbook. I mean, it's racism, white supremacy. I don't know what other thing I could say about it. I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all. I think they think all of the so-called Native American land is theirs. You know, they eventually plan on getting it from them eventually at some point. And I'll mute my line.
They were protesting here in Seattle, Washington, as well. When I say they, I mean whites. Now, there is a substantial population of individuals who are classified as natives, indigenous, whichever, first people, whichever term you want to use. But most of these folks are non-white. There are a substantial population of them here in Washington State, but the images that I saw that were on the news of the people that were out protesting here in Washington State, they were protesting against different banks that are funding this drilling operation in North Dakota. It looked like it was a lot of white people out running around in the street, which happens typically if there's anything. Like when the Ferguson protests happened and they protested here, it was mostly white people. That tends to be the way things go. So seeing that and even some other images where it looked like there were a substantial number of whites who were out jumping up and down on this, it kind of reminded me of the report about Black Lives Matter in the UK, where they were out protesting at the airport, where they included that it seemed like it was a substantial number of whites, if not a majority of whites, were out doing this under the banner of Black Lives Matter, where I thought, you know, this could just be whites that are out, you know, causing some distraction or what have you. They get really excited and want you to be really upset about things where they say, oh, this is the environment and this is going to mess things up for the environment, that sort of thing. Where in my view, it is a total lie, and it is disingenuous, because if you are a white person and you want to get that riled up about, you know, we can't have all this pollution and we cannot toxify the land or the water or the air, what have you, then we should be equally, if not more so, like infinitely more so, upset and outraged about abusing, terrorizing other black people. And I just don't see that. So that it had a big impact on my view of what was transpiring in North Dakota, because I was thinking that there were a lot of whites that were out doing this, and this was just obfuscating and distracting away from the global enterprise of white supremacy. But I did see the non-white people being bitten by dogs and that going down. So I said I maybe just need to take another look and get some more of the reports where they're actually non-white people that are out and protesting and are involved in this sincerely. But I did see, unfortunately, I did see quite a bit of people that I think are racist out clowning and joining in this as well.
Yeah, I was going to say about that. Definitely white people are going to come out and, you know, have their fun while other non-white people are being mistreated. But when I saw the dogs attacking the non-white people, it just made me think that even though people who are non-black and non-white are lighter or less melanated than we are, essentially all
non-white people are just variations of black people to white people. And at some point, no matter how light you are, they're going to show you that you're just a nigga too. And to me, that it's like Thomas was saying, it did kind of take me back to, you know, the days in the South with the dogs and the fire hoses. And it's just, you know, in that particular moment, they were getting the nigga treatment. And I think it's a great example for other people who are non-black, non-white, to understand that anything that is not white in the mind of white people are just variations of black people. And at some point, you're going to get that treatment. It's just that the vast majority of the time, it is the darkest of them all that get treated the most brutally out of everyone else. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Just wanted to say thing about the gentleman in Ferguson that was killed, Darren. I think his name is Darren. And, you know, I just happened to be one day, I was sitting at work going through YouTube, and I came across this interview, and the interview that he did. The interview was done with Irritated Genie. And, you know, I just wanted to say, he talked to him, and so he was in the interview, he was talking about, I mean, you know, he got killed, and that's how I was saying interview. It's like, because I think that we all know that, you know, this is some law enforcement took care of him, you know. And in this interview, though, that he did with the Irritated Genie, he was talking about what was going on, like, you know, right after the time Mike Brown was executed. And there were just things, I mean, it was just like, I don't know, maybe just shocking to me, you know. And he was talking about how the LGBTQ, the, you know, homosexuals, because he mentioned DeRay McKeeson. And he said how they were coming to this area, Ferguson. And he said they were making big money. He talked about how whites were coming in, starting fights, you know, and he said they were making big money. And he talked about some guys that he knew, a black guy, and it was something about renting this apartment. He says he goes to this apartment. The guy there said he goes to this apartment. This black guy is there with this white guy. He rented this apartment, I guess, for this white guy to come to town. And he said the black guy was telling him, he said, this white guy is making money off of this. He there said that the black guy was sleeping on like a phone or one of these type of mattresses, you know, that you blow up. He said the white guy was sleeping in the bed. And then he said something like the black guy said he had to take the white guy to the grocery store. He said this guy had something like $9,000 on his card. And he said this guy was just sitting up there always on that laptop. So he was just making money. And so then the guy there was saying about how it was some guy they knew. They went to the UN. He said then that guy come back and he was writing rap songs. And he was like saying that these people were making money. And he said the people who lived in the area were just basically like getting just messed over. I mean, I was sitting there listening to that interview, and I was like, wow, you know, and then I kept looking, I said, this is the guy that just got killed. But I just, you know, I just wanted to put that out there because, I mean, if he, you know, was speaking truth to power, it's just so sad that he's dead, but it's almost like, when I said, I could see why they killed him. And then probably, you know, because I guess that interview took place a little bit after Mike Brown was, executed. So, and that's been, what, a couple of years? You know, and so now, you know, I know he was just killed, you know, a few days ago. So if he's, you know, still keeping up his activism, then whoever killed him is just like, this was somebody that had to be done away with. And I was reading the article right before he got killed where it said that something about he was out with his brothers and his brother and the police stopped him and was, you know, kind of like telling them, be careful, you know, kind of like a warning. You know, to him. And then I know I was looking at some pictures today on Facebook, and they were talking about, they had pictures of the scene with this fire, the car fire, you know, and it was just a lot of stuff left back there, like a door, you know, it was just some other stuff there. And so the question was like, well, what kind of investigation is this? And I remember I wrote on there, I said, it's a non-investigation. You know, they know what happened to him. That law enforcement down in the area know what happened to him, know who did it to him. So, you know, you clean up the mess, you leave some other stuff there, and you just go on. You know, they know what happened. But I just wanted to say that. And this was a thing, too, the gentleman that was talking about Lena Dunham and, that racist, I ain't going to call her suspected racist. I'm going to call her a racist, Amy Schumer. And I was I saw a little piece of a clip, and there's a, I have a Facebook friend, she's a professor, and she was saying how she had been writing some articles about Amy Schumer, who's basically like using feminism, trying to, you know, I'm a white, you know, I'm a feminist, but actually what she's saying is just racist. And she had written this article, and she had a film clip of her, Amy Schumer, her stand-up thing. And I mean, just, you can't any other way, just racist. And I remember I was just saying, I said, you know, we wouldn't even, you know, probably nobody would even heard about who this fat white girl is, if not because her cousin, if I'm mistaken, is the senator from New York, Charles Schumer. And I'm like, this is probably, this fat white girl's come on the scene. Just, you know, one day it just shows up, Amy Schumer. She and Lena Dunham, just two fat white girls. I'm trying to be nice about this. I mean, just racist. And then you wouldn't try to talk about you're a feminist. And it hurts me because black women will run to that. Oh, yeah, I'm a feminist too. And I'm like, it's just total opposite. So what the gentleman was saying about it, you know, I saw it as, I mean, he is 100% correct. And thank you. I'll mute myself. Thank you.
I would, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is Ken Still from Chicago. I'd also like to note that, yeah, Amy Schumer is Chuck Schumer's, Senator Chuck Schumer's cousin, I believe. And if you recall, it was her movie, Trainwreck, that was the scene of a mass shooting that took place. And she was subsequently instrumental in messaging a campaign to do away with, I think, semi-automatic weapon sales or something like that. Or, but yeah, it should be noted that, yes, she does have very, very powerful connections. And I suspect that there are greater forces at work that are beyond comedy that are definitely assisting her presence within the media. And it's just very peculiar to me in light of a lot of developments within her career, including revelations that she does, in fact, steal jokes, that so many notable comedians came to her defense or did not excoriate her in the same manner that other joke thieves like a non-white comedian, Carlos Mencia, got treated. So, all of these things should be noted about this comedian, Amy Schumer. And I guess I'll mute my mic.
Had to obligatory make sure that I get in since his name was mentioned. Irritated Genie, according to his own record, his own testimony, not Gus T. Renegade, admitted being employed for Homeland Security, not TSA or any other derivatives, Homeland Security. That should always be noted and brought up, mentioned when he is referenced. Anyone that we missed who has not commented, anyone that has not commented at all, wanted to make sure they get in. I don't. Or if other folks had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in as well, that is fine. Just make sure you do not wait till the last minute.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think I had never heard that she was Chuck Schumer's cousin before. But, I mean, I just look at her last name, and you look at who runs Hollywood, and who could get you on television. And just like Jerry Seinfeld and a lot of other corny white comedians, they become big stars. So that doesn't shock me at all. What I wanted to say was the name of that religion is called Terrasism. And what T-E-R-A-S-E-M, and what stands out about this religion is the black man, their half-son, half-black son, is essentially like the pope of this religion, the head person, and I just thought that was very interesting. Also, I just wanted to mention a story that wasn't brought out, and, you know, to me, I find racism and everything.
I just would love to know how does a bank like Wells Fargo have fired 5,400 people and no one go to jail? I mean, black people are put in jail every day for minuscule crimes, not going into people's bank accounts and giving them fake credit cards and things. And I just find that as a huge act of racism, selective prosecution. White people get treated one way in the criminal justice system, and the blueprint for treating black people is we always end up with a mandatory minimum or all-white jury, and it never works out in our favor. But 5,400 people are fired for stealing money, and no one goes to jail. And imagine any black organization where that could happen. I'm with my mom.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Person at 0821, 0821, did you have commentary?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to go back to the Amy Schumer and feminism comment. Is that okay?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. What I wanted to add to the conversation is that for all their talk about feminism and being independent, let's face it, without white supremacy, these white women would not have the benefits that they have to even call themselves feminists. So when, you know, when they make remarks like this, when they talk about their independence, when they talk about gender bending and all this other stuff, Lena Dunham wearing a tuxedo and not getting attention for it, that all of that is part of the white supremacist agenda. And all this talk about not relying on men, but where are they getting all this white power from? They're getting it from white men. So it's time for all of us, especially us non-white women, to start calling them out. Because if it weren't for their men, they wouldn't have these privileges. And to also be sure, with absolute certainty, white men only give white women a certain amount of power, the type of power that keeps the wealth in their families and in their white community. So they're not breaking any barriers under the context of feminism.
Oh, right on. That was all you wanted to share?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right on. Before I nab any other folks, I did want to mention, I thought just one word that was used when they in the report where they were talking about cannabis legalization and Trump's stance, Hillary Clinton's stance, and if that's going to be an issue as we move towards November, when Hillary Clinton was quoted as saying that she was looking at the states where they have legalized as laboratories. I've pointed out pretty regularly for years now, actually, that sort of language, laboratories, experiments, that those are the type of words that they have consistently used with all of this. And I think that is very important. I am not, it is not my view that whites are ignorant or stupid. I do not have that view at all. You cannot be stupid and maintain global domination for a long, long time, which they clearly have. You cannot do that if you are a dunce. They do experiments. And I think all of this with everything about the drugs, the heroin in the libraries, legalization of cannabis, less legalized, all of this is directly connected to racism, white supremacy. I think more of this, I don't know, I guess the people that are in the states that are going to be voting on legalizing cannabis, if we have people that are in Arizona, California, Maine, Massachusetts, or Nevada, those are the five states that are voting on legalization, how this is going. I would bet the farm that this is going to pass in California, so that would be another one to check off the people who years ago said that they're not doing any legalization in states where they have significant population of black people. I don't think anybody would say that there are no black people in California. Certainly, you have black people in D.C. where it has been legalized as well. But I would just pay attention to that when they're saying that these are experiments. These states are laboratories where we are just experimenting with how we are going to use drugs, legal or no, to help us strengthen our domination over dark people. That's my view of all of this. I could be in error. Other folks have commentary. We have less than 30 minutes to go.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I was just thinking about what the I believe it was a previous female caller was speaking about in regards to feminism. And it made me think of a great article I read. If anyone wants to find it, you can search for it by putting in Black Women Feminism Gloria Steinem and the CIA. And they basically discussed the history of the fact that feminism, especially for black people, was facilitated via the CIA, giving Gloria Steinem millions of dollars to essentially indoctrinate black women into feminism to facilitate the destruction of the black family. So anytime I hear any black person, male or female, say that they're a feminist, I just say, well, wow, you really just don't know history. And, you know, I leave it at that. But ultimately, you know, it was created as a ruse to facilitate what we're seeing today, the destruction of the black family, the propagation of anti-sexual behavior, something that's normal, all of the stuff we're seeing today began then. And in the article, they give like a lot of great facts about everything. They give details about her relationship with the CIA. So I think it's something people want to look into, especially those people who might call themselves black feminists, whether male or female. I just think it's a history that we need to be fully aware of so that we know when we're engaging in this sort of activity, we're doing something that's completely anti our own selves. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just want to give, based on this story I heard with the, I believe it was a black firefighter who was assaulted. Am I correct?
In
one of the clips?
Yes, in Missouri. He was called a nigger and assaulted with a cane by a 70-year-old white man.
In my younger days, I kind of like wish... I was that black firefighter with that old, with that white man with the cane. it happens more than probably reported, for various reasons. For the most part, a lot of the, emergency calls that take place, the police are also responding to it. So in that case, it sometimes doesn't happen, but let's say it's a medical emergency. In some cases, the police are not necessarily responding. And from there, there may be problems. I've had some violent experiences. One in particular, this is about maybe about 25 years ago, so it's kind of like hard to remember, but what I do remember, it was something like 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And the police were on the call, but they were not in a hurry to go inside the house. I was kind of like, well, I wasn't in my first year, but it was something like maybe third year on, and kind of aggressive, and went into the house, and white male, no clothes on, bloody all over. I went to get some swab to be able to see where the source of his bleeding. And while I did that, he took the opportunity to get a he was laying around in a bunch of glass shards, some of them as long as some like a foot long. And when I took the turn to turn my back, he actually came at me and stabbed me in the back with this shard. But at the same time, I noticed him coming and turned and tried to break his arm in the process. The only thing it did was nick my, I was wearing a jumpsuit. He kind of like nicked the jumpsuit. And it was the scratch was kind of like superficial, but it does happen a lot. As far as that concern. And so you have to be, you know, careful. And even, I mean, I've had incidents with non-white black people also. For whatever reason, it may not be the patient, him or herself, but it's maybe somebody else in the general vicinity of an apartment. And in this particular case, a brick was thrown with the intent to let me know that they are around, because I'm pretty sure if the person wanted to hit me with the brick, I wasn't that far away from them, unless there's something really wrong with their ability to throw a brick. But, yeah, it happens quite often. I was just thinking about my past connected with this incident involving that, and I would have actually gotten, it'd have been my opportunity to really get physical with a white person in that particular case. One more particular case was one of these situations, quote unquote, exclusive golf course of where white people still had a large membership in an area where white people had moved out is a approximately about maybe five minutes south of the Dolphin Stadium, on the same major street, and we would get calls over there, and it was obvious on the shift that I was on because they had a lot of non-white black males, and they were not pleased. They were not pleased with us on a lot of the calls of us going to the calls, and all they see was black males, and most of these black males that I worked with at this particular time were not confused on racism and white supremacy. And I can recall this particular incident, we stopped service since they didn't act like they wanted to appreciate our service, so we stopped service. We just sat there and waited until, in this particular case, it was something that required an ambulance. We didn't do anything, just sit there since they didn't want the service. You know, as far as that concerned, and so we just sat there and didn't apply the service. And in that case, if the patients or whatever are being belligerent, and there's some means that something physical could happen, and I mean, nobody's going to come at me and say that I have to apply some kind of service to that person. And myself and a few others, we just sat down and let other people do the work as far as that concerned. Those are some of my remembrance of things similar to what that firefighter went through. Thank you.
Appreciate that. I thought with that piece with the black firefighter in Missouri who was terrorized, assaulted, called a nigger, in the clip, I thought it was telling that they moved away from this was a blatant act of white supremacy, white terrorism, to we need to get these hate crime bills to include attacks on enforcement officers and firefighters and all of this other talk that's been going on for the last 2 months or so, maybe even a little longer than that, and saying that there needs to be hate crime penalties if someone attacks or harms an enforcement officer, police officers in particular, and some of the legislation, the Blue Lives Matter legislation that they passed, including them in hate crimes, which I thought that could have been even a subtle act of white supremacy racism right there, because I think people have pointed out consistently that in most states they already have penalties in place, severe additional penalties if someone mistreats, violates, particularly police officers, enforcement officials. They already have that, so that you already know that you're going to get stiffer punitive action if you violate, assault, harm a police officer. So I thought that was important. Could be another act of racism there. We also had a listener who wrote in the first piece news clip that we played this evening about Make It Awkward, this campaign in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. They had the mayor, who's a suspected racist, Don Iveson, on the program. I thought it was significant. He divulged that he is married to a non-white person and has, as he stated, quote-unquote, biracial children or children that are racially ambiguous. Can be difficult to pick out if they are classified as white or if they're classified as non-white. Listener wrote in, he said, the gentleman being interviewed, who was Mayor Don Iveson, was using terms like casual racism and awkward conversation, which I believe did not accurately describe what they were talking about, as a function of white supremacy, giving the context of the conversation. Number one, can you define what is casual racism? Number two, I think Don Iveson had divulged that he and the black male that they started with, he was doing a public service announcement for how what a wonderful city Edmonton is, and some whites drove by and said, the niggers are coming, the niggers are coming. I played that last week, that both Mr. Iveson and this black male, Jesse, I'm just forgetting his last name, that they both are in, it seems, tragic arrangements. Don Iveson is married to a non-white female. Her name is Sarah Chan. And Jesse, I forget his last name, I can tell you in a second. I think, unfortunately, this black male is in some sort of tragic arrangement with a white woman. But it seems they both have, I think the common term, unfortunately, is quote-unquote biracial children. And he tried to offer that as some evidence of his sincerity. And he has some stake in addressing these issues. Other folks have commentary they want to make sure they get in. We have about 10 minutes left.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
You just referred to the relationship with the black male and the Chinese female or the Asian female as a tragic arrangement. So does that also apply under the definition of a tragic arrangement?
It was
a black male with a non-white female.
It was the white mayor who is in a tragic arrangement with a non-white female, Sarah
Chan.
Yeah. Hope I was not confusing.
Sorry.
There.
No. I thought it was a black male with a white Chinese female. So I was like, wow. But oh, I got you 100% now.
Right on. Other folks?
I wanted to chime in because I was reading earlier today that John Hinckley Jr. is now being released from a mental hospital in Washington, D.C., and that's the white guy who shot Ronald Reagan in the 80s. And I thought about it. I was like, wow, this is very interesting. When you're white and you shoot a president, you get to go to a mental hospital, and they release you after a number of years. When you're white and you assassinate a senator and murder 8 other black people in a church, you get a Burger King meal and protection. You also get forgiven by some of the family members of your victims. And when you're black and unarmed, just walking down the street doing nothing, you get bullets, whether it's from a killer cop or a George Zimmerman, and it's, you know, considered a justifiable homicide. So I just find that to be an interesting example of how white supremacy works. And that's it. Thank you.
Just quick note to attach. The Dallas police chief, David Brown, a lot of people saw him during the shooting that took place earlier in the summer with the 5 enforcement officials who were reportedly killed. And they said that the gunman, allegedly Micah Xavier Johnson, he retired within the last few days. I thought that was noteworthy. They did give this black male a lot of attention during all of that. There's one other comment I was going to get in. I'll make sure I include it before we get ready to wrap things up. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they address? The Attica situation. If folks are interested, I know we have film fans. One of Samuel L. Jackson's better works, Against the Wall, is about the Attica uprising. Obviously, it is not a documentary with Samuel L. Jackson in it, but it is pretty good. You should be able to find it online. They have it in parts on YouTube. I think it might be missing like one part, maybe an hour into the film, and then it has the rest of it. But I'm sure you should be able to find it online or wherever else. But it is pretty interesting. Against the Wall is the name of it, starring Samuel L. Jackson.
That movie with Clarence Williams III in it.
I'm sorry?
That's the movie with Clarence Williams III in it.
Give me a moment and I will let you know. Yes, he is in it as well. Yes.
Yeah, that's a good movie.
Hey, Gus.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I just wanted to add in, you know, while we're talking about racist white women, Amy Schumer and Lena Dunham, you must also include the racist Klan member, Chelsea Handler. All three are nasty, body milky, bad body, nasty shape, Klan members. Just wanted to add that in there.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
To go along with that last comment,
Chelsea Handler, in her book, refers to her black boyfriend as, I believe, throughout the book as Tyrone. And I don't believe that that was his name. So that's kind of thing about that says something about Chelsea Handler. And then on top of that, I believe she was involved in some sort of a publicity stunt whereby she and the rapper 50 Cent, Curtis Jackson, he and her were purported to be in some sort of a tragic arrangement together as well. It seemed very tacky in the way that this was presented. It was perplexing to me because it didn't seem like it was presented as something genuine. It seemed like it was the intro to some sort of skit or a bit or some sort of joke. So that's something to note about Chelsea Handler. That's a significant part of her act is revolves around engaging in gutter sex with non-white males. So that's definitely something to note about that character in this trifecta of comedic white women feminism that we've been discussing throughout the night. Thank you.
Did folks...
Also,
go ahead.
I just wanted to chime in too, just to just give a maximum respect to Peter Tosh. The anniversary of his death is actually tomorrow, September 11th. And there's a great documentary on him called Steppin' Razor Red X that anyone can find on YouTube. It's very, very incredible. And it basically, a lot of it's in his own words. He recorded himself before he died, and he knew he was going to be killed, so he basically started recording himself months before he was killed. And essentially, it follows his story. It's almost like a autobiography, and they play a lot of the tapes that he actually recorded of himself. So it's a really brilliant documentary. I would say the best one ever done on him. And I just wanted to put that out there as well. Thank you.
For sure. Did anyone see what the report, Beyonce's sister, Solange, I think she made a report within the last few hours, 48 hours or so, that she was at a concert in Louisiana and some white women were yelling at her. I guess she was standing at this concert, which seems to be, you know, a typical thing. But these white women were upset and they threw a lime at her and were telling her to sit down and get out of the way. I don't know if they recognized her or not, or even if they cared. But they apparently were yelling at her, and she talked about how this is why black people do not feel safe in what she termed white spaces. Did anybody catch that or have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. This lady was at a Kraftwerk concert. You know, the group that made up those beats, they were at a Kraftwerk concert, and Solange typed out that they may have been like four. It was like less than 20 black people and thousands of white people. And so she was standing up dancing because they have sampled, hip hop artists have sampled a lot of Kraftwerk's singles. That's a German group in the 80s. But, you know, she was dancing, and they not only did they throw it at Solange, they threw it at her son also.
Okay. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yes, like Puff said, I did see that, and I noticed too, because what I saw on Twitter, well, what the article I saw, it was like she's 30, and these white women were older, so that, you know, that says something too. And just like you say, that right there, and then the, I think it was Ron who was saying about how things that white people could do and how the law enforcement would slap their wrists if they do that. But, you know, if we're out walking down the street minding our business and, you know, somebody, white police officer, have a bad day, we could be shot up and be made to look like Swiss cheese before it's all over with. And that, and I say all that to say, and I think really if black people, I don't like this term waking up. I remember one time somebody said that, and I remember you would say, how do we determine that? But I mean, I don't know. I just, we got to pay attention, we got to focus and stuff. And because basically, if anybody remembers now, the systems are not working for us. The Supreme Court has gutted the Voting Rights Act, which we shouldn't even have to have that today. But we see after the Supreme Court did that, we saw what Alabama did, closed down all their DMVs. And, I mean, it was crazy. Although they closed all the DMVs in areas that had large black populations. So you wouldn't be able to get an ID so that you could register to vote. We see what North Carolina is doing, how they are just every which way they can. I even think I read some report this week that they want to have one place, I guess, in the whole state where you can have early voting. And then, remember, they had a case that went to the Supreme Court, and I think the Supreme Court overturned it or something, which basically said they can't do what they were trying to do. So, you know, it's just really sad that we even have to have a Voting Rights Act. But we saw after the Supreme Court gutted it what they did. Supreme Court gutted the Fourth Amendment. Remember, about 3 months back, Justice Sonia Sotomayor writes this dissent where she says, basically, black people and Latinos are going to bear the brunt of this, you know, and how the application of it, because it's pretty much gutted. And as you can see, black people, I'm going to see much is happening with Latinos, but you can see black people, we are bearing the brunt of this now. Police come to your car, you can talk about rights and stuff. They don't care about that. You know, they would bust car windows. They would do what they feel that they have to do to escalate a situation to effect an arrest or a death, whichever would come first. So, and then, you know, now we see the uptick in white women, whereas back historically, not that white women weren't doing anything, but you see now the Amy Schumers, that, anyway, the fat Lena Dunham, you know, and there are others. You know, we remember the case last year with about the pool party, and then black girl, the police officer, running down the street like he in some movie, and the little black girl that was arrested. So we're seeing things going on, and I mean, I don't like to say wake up, but I'm like, we have to focus because none of the systems now are working for black people. None of them. You know, police are out here, like I say, there's no more Fourth Amendment rights, and we are catching pure hell because of that. So I saw that, and, you know, like you said, you know, older white women, I don't care whether they're older, just white women, you know, now, you know, stepping up very boldly and being emboldened in their foolishness. So I did. I saw that, and I just wanted to say that, and I'll mute myself and thank you.
Right on. I did see we had people predictably wait till the last minute to dial in, and true to my word, as I said, we are not doing any extra when people hang out and lollygag. We're here and they don't want to talk, or are on the line with a hand up and don't want to talk, and then decide that they want to wait till we get to the last 3 minutes. Now I got whatever together that I want to say. No, get yourself together. I think we've been on for a long enough time. People should know the pattern in terms of the program and how long they were on. I think you have a significant amount of time if you need, you know, a moment to collect your thoughts or figure out how you want to articulate yourself. You've had adequate time, and we're not hanging out extra. I will give a documentary in addition if people are looking to get more details on Attica, Ghosts of Attica, that is available online. You should check that out. They have a lot of archival footage of what went down. Might be good to check out if folks want to do a little extra research. I had one other comment, but I will just save it for later. Oh, my other comment, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she mentioned, I was going back and listening to the archives, and she mentioned a lot of different books. One of the books that she mentioned was Marcus Rediker, who is a white male, suspected race soldier. His book, The Slave Ship, where she said she just got it. I think this was like 2011. The book hadn't been out that long at that point. But she said she just got it. She recommended people read that. Mr. Rediker should be coming on the program in a few weeks if you want to get a copy of The Slave Ship and prepare. I had asked him to come on the program earlier this summer, but he was occupied. And I went back, touched base again, and we should be doing it in, I think, like 2 weeks, right kind of towards the end of September. He'll be on the broadcast. Interestingly enough, he divulged that he was one of the consultants on the Roots remake. That's like his area of expertise, since he's not ignorant about racism, is studying the enslavement of black people. He's written quite a few books on it, but he divulged that he, I think I might have mentioned Roots to him when I was making my request for him to come on the program, but he divulged that as well. So folks that were interested in that might want to prepare. Should be interesting to speak with a white person on this subject matter. We'll be looking forward to that later in the summer. And that came to me as I was asking him to come on the program. I think that also has greatly informed why I'm so disinterested in seeing any more slave films about black bondage. It's not that I don't spend time researching this subject. I don't need to go and see Quentin Tarantino or 12 Years a Slave or any of these other racist cinema adaptations. There's quite a bit of literature out there, and I do make an effort to read quite a bit. I think this will be our fifth program this year, focusing on a book that is specifically about the enslavement of black people. I think that also is probably a grand contributor to why I'm not going to see Nate Parker's work, and I'm not going to watch the new Roots or any of the other slave flicks that they have coming down the road. There are a plenty. If you look online, you'll see that whites are just going to keep cramming those in and keep cramming those in and keep cramming those in. I think that in and of itself is an act of racism, white supremacy, reminding us of what our status is, not trying to correct the problem. With that, we should be here. You'll just have to check the Black Talk Radio network page to get the exact dates, times for the coming broadcasts. Again, we are restored on TuneIn, so you can check there. You can hit us on Twitter at Until Justice. If you get confused along the way, feel free, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. I will give a tip. If you have a guest suggestion, someone that you would like on the program, it would be best to send it to the Gmail account. People can send me messages on Facebook, but it is more difficult for me to keep things organized there. It's much easier for me to organize and keep track of things on Gmail. It can be things can just get lost because people send enough messages on Facebook, and for me it can just be difficult to kind of keep up with things there. So if it's a guest suggestion or something that is important, a response or whatever the case is, send it to the Gmail account. That would be best. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Guest suggestion, if you can't find an archive, if you just general information you would like to share, gripe, complaint, whatever it is, UntilJustice@gmail.com. With that, thank you for tuning in. I hope the broadcast has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. As I state consistently, one of the worst combinations in the known universe, whites, alcohol. Keep that in mind at all times and do not take it lightly. Certainly if you're going to be in a vehicle, driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence. Sobriety would be best under conditions of racism, white supremacy. You do not want to be inebriated on the day that you happen to bump into Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, race soldier, badge or no, as was stated earlier in the broadcast. Racists, whites can ruin your life, end your life in a matter of minutes, if not seconds, and they demonstrate that daily, worldwide. Sobriety would be best. And if you're going to be in a vehicle, buckle up every time. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. A victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.